Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
It's not hard to find galleries selling art from Northwest coastal tribes. Some of the work dates back generations. But buying that kind of art can bring up ethical questions. Ann Dornfeld from KUOW's Race and Equity team has more.
When Bruce Jacobson moved to Seattle in the 1980s, he fell in love with the Pacific Northwest. He wanted to express his appreciation with a piece of Native art. He found just the thing at a gallery in Pioneer Square, a Chilkat robe.
I just thought it was so beautiful, and it was like nothing I had seen before.
It was a six-foot-long blanket, hand-woven out of mountain goat fur.
It's a completely symmetric pattern of geometric shapes and also shapes that come from the culture. And then it's just perfectly made. You can see no seams in it at all.
The tribe or clan it came from isn't clear, but it would have been made around the turn of the century by the Tlingit, Haida, or Tsimshian peoples of Alaska and British Columbia. Jacobson bought the robe and hung it on his dining room wall. His 19-year-old daughter, Sarah, grew up eating family dinners beneath the Chilkat robe. She never thought much about it. Then she saw a picture of a strikingly similar robe in her high school art history class.
The teacher told us how it was used in some kind of spiritual ceremony for the tribe, something about like supernatural and like shape-shifting. And I started to wonder why we had it in our house when we're not Native American.
Sarah Jacobson says she asked her dad a few questions. Bruce Jacobson calls that an understatement.
I felt like I was on the wrong side of a protest rally, basically, with terms like cultural appropriation and sacred ceremonial robes and completely inappropriate in terms like that.
I feel like in our country, there are so many things that white people have taken that aren't theirs, and I just didn't really want to continue that pattern in my family.
Well, I got defensive at first, of course. I said, oh, come on, Sarah, this is like more of the political stuff that you all say these days.
But Jacobson decided to investigate. He emailed experts at the Burke Museum, which has a huge collection of Native art and artifacts.
Well, I got this very eloquent email back that said, we're not going to tell you what to go do. But then they confirmed what Sarah said, that it was an important ceremonial piece, that it was usually owned by an entire clan, that it would be passed down generation to generation, and that it had a ton of cultural significance to them.
Jacobson says he was a bit disappointed to learn that his daughter was right, but he and his wife now no longer thought of the robe as theirs. He asked the curators at the Burke Museum for suggestions of institutions that would do the Chilkat robe justice. They told him about the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau.
I was stunned. I was shocked. I was in awe. And I was so grateful to the Jacobson family.
Rosita Worrell directs the institute. She says the robe has a huge monetary value, but it's precious to tribes for other reasons.
It's what we call at'ul. It is a sacred clan object. Our beliefs are that it is imbued with the spirits of not only the crest itself, but also of our ancestors. And also, it unites us as a people.
Since the Jacobsons returned the robe, master weavers have been examining it and marveling at the handiwork. Chilkat robes can take a year to make, and hardly anyone still weaves them.
Our master artist said it was absolutely a spectacular robe. She said the circles were absolutely perfect. So it does have that importance to us that it could also be used by our younger weavers, you know, to study the art form itself.
Worrell says private collectors hardly ever return anything to her organization, but they're lobbying Congress to improve their chances.
We are working on a better tax credit system that might benefit collectors so that they could be compensated.
Worrell hopes stories like this will encourage people to look differently at the native art and artifacts they possess. The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute welcomed home the Chilkat robe in a two-hour ceremony over the weekend. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
That's why we have to think as black people. Stop singing and dancing and start thinking.
Wow.
Thinking and reading. I say reading is more important than watching TV. And not getting addicted to looking at those small iPhone screens. See, where you were getting accustomed to looking there in a narrow space as opposed to paying attention broadly to what is happening around you.
Starting today, the Seattle Public Library will no longer charge fees for overdue books and other media. And it's wiping away past fines for thousands of patrons, meaning they'll be able to check out materials once again. KUOW's online managing editor, Isolde Raftery, is here with more. Hi, Isolde.
Hey, Guy.
So how many library patrons will be able to borrow again because of this policy change?
Get ready for a big number.
Mm-hmm.
51,000 people with Seattle library accounts will be able to check out books again starting today. And of those, 4,200 are kids. So wrap your brain around that number. That's 9 elementary schools worth of kids who could not check out books in Seattle, and probably even more couldn't check out books because they relied on their parents' accounts to check out books, and their parents' accounts were blocked.
51,000 people. Wow. So why did the Seattle Public Library decide to do this?
There are a few reasons. So for one, the library believes in access for all. It's part of their mission statement, right? And no librarian believes money should be a barrier to literacy. And just speaking with librarians around town, I spoke with a librarian at the Fremont Library who was doing a literal happy dance telling me that fines would be vanquished today. I was actually just checking out material there. And when I asked why she was so pleased, she said she hopes to see more people coming back into the library, people who couldn't afford to pay their fines and unblock their accounts, but also because she hopes that the library will see a whole bunch of books coming back in, books that have been hiding on people's bookshelves over the years because, like, it didn't really matter. They had too many fines and they weren't going to be able to unblock their accounts. And I don't know about you, but if you can't check out books anyway, like, why bother even returning the books if you can't even unblock your account?
Well, that makes sense. How much income does the library receive from fines each year?
So to give you an idea, in 2018, the library received $1.2 million from people paying fines. So it's not a huge part of the budget, but it's not insignificant either. And by the way, this is where I should pause and tell you that Seattle is forgiving past fines too, not just future fines. So Seattle will wipe out a whopping $2.6 million in fines. And the reason they've been able to forgive all these fines is because of a robust library levy passed by Seattle voters last year in 2019. And this means that the library no longer has to rely on money from fines to fund their operation. And Guy, so speaking personally,
mm-hmm.
I pay about $100 a year in library fines. And I went into my account a few minutes ago before stepping in here to speak with you, and I saw $0 in fines, so I can attest that they have made good on this promise.
Great. Well, you are such a scofflaw. Well, now that these fines are going away, is the library expecting an increase in borrowing?
They are. They are expecting an increase in borrowing. The library interviewed patrons a while back and learned that library debt led to feelings of shame and a reluctance to use the library. And research backs this up. It shows that fines discourage library use, and that's definitely the case here in Seattle, where library branches in quote-unquote low-opportunity neighborhoods have more blocked accounts than in, you know, these quote-unquote high-opportunity neighborhoods. And I talked with people about this, and so many people have stories of a kid they know or a friend who is low income and who doesn't go to the library because they have a blocked account. And maybe now those people will get to go back.
Okay, so just to be clear, you still don't get to keep these things if you have them, right? The library will charge you for books and other materials that have not yet been returned?
Yeah, this is not like the library is not turning into a free bookstore. You don't get to borrow a book and keep it forever and not face any consequence. You still have to return the books or get charged for lost material.
KUOW's online managing editor, Isolde Raftery. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks, Guy.
People are always looking for a way out of their misery. A lot of them are going to have a curiosity about Malcolm X, and they'll go to see it out of curiosity. But mostly they're going to go the way that their heart wishes, and that is that those white people love us. Kevin Costner is crazy about me. I know he is, because I look as good as, what's her name? Yes. Or I can fix myself up to look as good as Whitney, you know. And I'll catch me a Kevin, just like on the soap operas. All right? You might say, well, I don't think that way. Somebody thinks this way. A lot of people went to see the movie. I don't think they were white women either. All right? Who went to see the movie more than anybody? You guess. And why? There's a reason why we do things. Romance. Like this is Valentine's month, okay? Old Saint Valentine. Chocolates and hearts, and you didn't send me no card.
A dispute over accusations of racism has erupted within the Romance Writers of America, the industry group which represents nearly 10,000 writers. Romance, despite a temptation to reduce it to heaving bosoms, is a hugely read genre with tremendous and growing financial power. Karen Grigsby Bates is a correspondent with the NPR Code Switch team, and she's been following the story. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Layla. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So before we say exactly what happened, we should explain to people what the RWA is and how it got started.
Okay. RWA is the largest organization of writers in the country, as I understand it. It has almost 10,000 members.
Wow.
Not all the writers are published writers. You know, everybody's working on a novel. But about 20% of them are published writers, and a percentage of those are real romance genre superstars. This is important because, as you said, romance is hugely profitable. It is, in fact, as I've been told, the most profitable arm of the publishing industry,
really?
Even though it doesn't get a lot of respect from the publishing industry, although that may be changing.
So last week, there was a big scandal. What happened?
We have to get in the Wayback Machine for a minute and go back to August, when a romance writing star named Courtney Milan wrote a series of tweets on her website that complained about what she said were racist descriptions of Asian women in a book written in 1999 by Catherine Lynn Davis, who referred to Chinese women in one of her books as sort of demure, submissive, and compliant. And Courtney took issue with this because she said, excuse me, you know, I'm half Chinese, and that is really offensive. This is just a racist mess. Sometime after that, Davis, who is white, and her publisher, Susan Tisdale, who is also white, and her editor and her friend, sent a complaint to RWA. And they claimed that Milan was in violation of RWA's code of ethics, which says that it's supposed to create a safe, respectful place in which to discuss people's works.
Wait, she was in violation for calling out what she saw as racist?
Yeah, they were offended that they had been, or that the writing, I guess, had been deemed racist, and they wanted her to apologize for being offended at the racism.
So,
is your head spinning yet?
Yes. What has the reaction of the membership been to all this?
Well, the membership didn't know about it for a long time because, as I said, this happened at the end of August. RWA initiated, which people are still kind of freaking out about, a subcommittee of its ethics committee. I guess they appointed some people, kind of like a grand jury, impaneled them. So this committee met in secret and decided that most of what they said about Milan wasn't accurate, but that they did think that because of the tweets, she should be sanctioned. And so they suspended her for a year, and they said she'd never again be allowed in any leadership positions. And this was a woman who had just received a service award the year before for her leadership in the organization. Someone leaked it. And a lot of writers of color were like, oh, no, 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 no. A lot of allies who were white women said, this is ridiculous. A lot of people in publishing is like, girls, you need to get yourselves together. And within a week, because this was blowback that RWA leadership had not expected, they changed their minds and said on the 30th of December, we've rescinded our decision about Courtney for right now because we need to have a fuller investigation. So she can keep doing what she's doing for the moment, to which Milan said, as you can imagine, yeah, no, bye. A number of people have left, including a number of RWA board members, and that's troublesome because this is the most diverse board RWA has had ever, ever. And of course, publishing is squirming because this is more than a $1 billion industry. And I think especially the gatekeepers to this industry, which had traditionally been white heterosexual women, are not at all comfortable with this.
So is there a sense that the RWA is going to make changes as a result of this, or are they doubling down?
I think the RWA isn't sure what it wants to do yet. You know, they're still dealing with the vertigo of how did this happen and what can we do to fix it? And so they have announced that they are going to have a investigation by an independent party to look at how this was done. They have proclaimed their feeling that they value the membership, that diversity is important to them, and that they want to fix this. But things are changing quickly, and if they don't adjust to change and format themselves so that the people that they want to reach, that they need to reach, feel included and welcomed, they will find that they have a much smaller organization if they have an organization at all.
Karen Grigsby Bates is a correspondent on NPR's Code Switch team. Thanks, Karen.
You're welcome.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Pain crises are a hallmark of sickle cell disease. It's a disease affecting 100,000 Americans, many of African or Hispanic descent. And for many of those people, the only way to control that pain is with powerful opioids, the same kind of drugs that are fueling the country's addiction crisis. That has made ER doctors rethink how they offer that medicine. Sam Whitehead at WABE in Atlanta reports.
India Hardy says having sickle cell disease means pain can strike at any time. It comes on when her red blood cells, forced into a sickle shape by the genetic condition, block her normal blood flow. Hardy sits on her mom's porch in Athens, Georgia, and remembers a recent pain crisis.
It was time for my daughter to get on the bus, and she's too young to go on her own, and I was in so much pain I couldn't walk. So she missed school that day.
The nearest specialized clinic for sickle cell patients is almost 2 hours away, and Hardy doesn't have a car, so she often goes to her local hospital, St. Mary's, for pain relief. Hardy says until recently, doctors in the emergency room would give her direct shots of the powerful opioid hydromorphone.
Now they would actually put that shot in a bag, which is full of fluids, so it's like you're getting small drips of pain medicine. So it's like torture.
But that's not how hospital staff see things. Troy Johnson is an ER doctor at St. Mary's. Giving patients IV drips of pain medication instead of direct injections was his idea.
We have given sickle cell patients a pass on they don't get addicted, which is completely false. And for us to not address that addiction is doing them a disservice.
Johnson says his own son has sickle cell. He's seen the way people with the disease are exposed to opioids from an early age. That experience informed the policy change. Hospital officials say they also consulted national guidelines for treating sickle cell. Dr. Lewis Ernest leads the ER.
We're trying to alleviate suffering, but we're also trying not to, you know, create addiction. And so we're trying to find that balance. Sometimes it's harder than others.
But those same national guidelines also say doctors should reassess patient pain frequently and adjust levels of opioids as needed. Ernest says St. Mary's new IV drip protocol is for all patients who come to the ER frequently for pain. And the hospital says most of their sickle cell patients are fine with the change. But some people who work closely with sickle cell patients say the drip delivery approach seems unusual. Dr. Bari Ondemariam is with the Sickle Cell Disease Association of America.
When individuals living with sickle cell disease go to emergency departments, they are living in extreme amounts of pain.
Ondemariam says that's why it's more common for ERs to give those patients direct pushes of medication, not slower drips. She says people with sickle cell aren't fueling the opioid crisis. They're not more likely to abuse the drugs than others.
So if anything, individuals with sickle cell disease in our country have really been caught in the crossfire when it comes to this opioid epidemic.
Ondemariam says ER doctors need more education on how to treat sickle cell pain. That's one goal of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The organization says the opioid epidemic has made it harder for sickle cell patients to get the pain medication they need. They've also asked federal health officials to speak out about sickle cell pain and fund research on how to treat it without opioids. Dr. John Mark Hirschon is vice president of the group.
We in the physician community are looking for ways to make sure they get adequate pain relief. We recognize that the process is not perfect, but this is what we're striving for to make a difference.
But back on her mom's porch in Athens, Georgia, India Hardy says she feels stuck. And she's not alone. Her brother and a friend, both with sickle cell, also report trouble finding pain relief at the St. Mary's ER.
It's just really frustrating because you go to them for help, expecting to get equal help, and you don't.
Hardy filed a complaint with the hospital, but she says nothing has changed. At this point, she's considering leaving her family and friends behind in Athens to move closer to a sickle cell clinic. She hopes doctors there will do a better job helping control her pain. For NPR News, I'm Sam Whitehead in Athens, Georgia.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
Live stream video from inside the West Freeway Church of Christ outside Fort Worth, Texas, shows many people at a service on Sunday. The video also shows a man opening fire, and authorities say he killed two people. Then a man identified as a member of the church volunteer security team shot and killed him. Saida Hassan of member station KERA has been following this story and joins us from Dallas via Skype. Good morning.
Good morning.
How did this event unfold?
Well, we saw on that video, churchgoers took cover under the pews as the gunman opens fire. Authorities say that the gunman actually sat with parishioners for part of that service before turning his gun on churchgoers. You can hear people screaming. It was truly a chaotic scene at the church. Almost immediately, though, another man fires at the gunman, who then falls to the ground. Multiple people approached the gunman with their guns drawn as he laid there. And the scene was quickly over just after it unfolded.
I guess you've been able to hear from the senior minister there, right?
Yes, that's right. So officials have said that the suspect was transient, but he had some connection to the area. We know that the congregation is expressing their gratefulness for the quick response of their armed security team. Britt Farmer is the church's senior minister. Let's listen to what he had to say.
We lost two great men today. But it could have been a lot worse. And I'm thankful that our government has allowed us the opportunity to protect ourselves.
Saida, tell me what is known about this volunteer security team. I guess we should note this is not random people in the congregation who happened to be armed, right? These were people who were prepared and trained in some way.
Right. So the video does show multiple people with their guns drawn. We don't know the size of that volunteer security team, but these were members of the church who volunteered in that capacity to serve as armed security for the church and responded to that attack. We don't know the extent of the training that they may had. Investigators were not open to disclosing those details just yet, but our Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has referred to them as a well-trained security team.
And in any case, they had a legal right to be armed inside that church. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So Texas law allows for people to carry guns in houses of worship. As you know, places of worship from different faiths have been targeted in violent attacks. And 2 years ago, 26 people were killed in a church shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas. So after that attack, Texas passed a law allowing people to carry firearms in houses of worship. And speaking at the scene yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick praised those gun laws and says the security team was able to put a quick end to this attack.
Can I ask about one particularly striking detail that you gave us? You said that according to this video, it appeared that the attacker sat in the congregation, sat next to the people he was about to attack, spent time with them, communed with them in that way, which, I don't know, makes it somehow even more disturbing. How are people responding to what this person then did?
The church community is truly in shock, and folks are really reeling from the attack. We know that the church leaders have planned a gathering this evening, a church-wide meeting to sort of help people begin the healing process, coming together and supporting each other in the wake of this tragedy. Minister Britt Farmer, who we heard from, tells us that they're simply asking for continued prayers from the community at this time.
Saida Hassan of our member station, KERA, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition.
Live stream video from inside the West Freeway Church of Christ outside Fort Worth, Texas, shows many people at a service on Sunday. The video also shows a man opening fire, and authorities say he killed two people. Then a man identified as a member of the church volunteer security team shot and killed him. Saida Hassan of member station KERA has been following this story and joins us from Dallas via Skype. Good morning.
Good morning.
How did this event unfold?
Well, we saw on that video, churchgoers took cover under the pews as the gunman opens fire. Authorities say that the gunman actually sat with parishioners for part of that service before turning his gun on churchgoers. You can hear people screaming. It was truly a chaotic scene at the church. Almost immediately, though, another man fires at the gunman, who then falls to the ground. Multiple people approached the gunman with their guns drawn as he laid there. And the scene was quickly over just after it unfolded.
I guess you've been able to hear from the senior minister there, right?
Yes, that's right. So officials have said that the suspect was transient, but he had some connection to the area. We know that the congregation is expressing their gratefulness for the quick response of their armed security team. Britt Farmer is the church's senior minister. Let's listen to what he had to say.
We lost two great men today, but it could have been a lot worse. And I'm thankful that our government has allowed us the opportunity to protect ourselves.
Saida, tell me what is known about this volunteer security team. I guess we should note this is not random people in the congregation who happened to be armed, right? These were people who were prepared and trained in some way.
Right. So the video does show multiple people with their guns drawn. We don't know the size of that volunteer security team, but these were members of the church who volunteered in that capacity to serve as armed security for the church and responded to that attack. We don't know the extent of the training that they may had. Investigators were not open to disclosing those details just yet, but our Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has referred to them as a well-trained security team.
And in any case, they had a legal right to be armed inside that church. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So Texas law allows for people to carry guns in houses of worship. As you know, places of worship from different faiths have been targeted in violent attacks. And 2 years ago, 26 people were killed in a church shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas. So after that attack, Texas passed a law allowing people to carry firearms in houses of worship. And speaking at the scene yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick praised those gun laws and says the security team was able to put a quick end to this attack.
Can I ask about one particularly striking detail that you gave us? You said that according to this video, it appeared that the attacker sat in the congregation, sat next to the people he was about to attack, spent time with them, communed with them in that way, which, I don't know, makes it somehow even more disturbing. How are people responding to what this person then did?
The church community is truly in shock, and folks are really reeling from the attack. We know that the church leaders have planned a gathering this evening, a church-wide meeting to sort of help people begin the healing process, coming together and supporting each other in the wake of this tragedy. Minister Britt Farmer, who we heard from, tells us that they're simply asking for continued prayers from the community at this time.
Saida Hassan of our member station, KERA,
Hitler,
thanks so much.
Had
Thank
the
you.
Supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation.
And we will begin on this eighth and final morning of Hanukkah with the story of the knife attack on a house full of Orthodox Jews celebrating the seventh night of Hanukkah on Saturday night in Muncie, the largely Orthodox community just off the thruway near Spring Valley in Rockland County. It's bad enough as an incident on its own, but it's even worse in the context of the increasing number of violent attacks on Jews just for being Jews in our area, even in the New York area, as well as elsewhere. Here's Governor Cuomo speaking yesterday.
It is an American cancer that is spreading in the body politic. An American cancer turns one cell in the body against the other.
And although that attack took place north of the Tappan Zee Bridge, here's Mayor de Blasio.
Well, there's a deep, deep connection between the Muncie community and New York City, and particularly Brooklyn. The attack on that community is an attack on this community, is an attack on all of us. We feel it that way.
With us now, Batya Unger-Sargon, editorial page editor of the Jewish theme news organization, The Ford. Hi, Batya. Welcome back to WNYC, and I'm so sorry it's under these circumstances.
Terrible circumstances. Thank you so much for having me and for your leadership, Brian.
Thank you. What's your understanding of what happened on Saturday night?
A gentleman who we now know has diagnosed schizophrenia walked into a rabbi's house where there was a big Hanukkah celebration. His face was covered, and he pulled out a machete the size of a broom, was what the people who were there said. He started stabbing people. A few individuals started throwing furniture at him. Five people were stabbed, and then he left and got in his car and drove to New York.
The New York Times puts this in the context of, quote, a string of anti-Semitic incidents in recent weeks. It occurred weeks after an anti-Semitic mass shooting at a kosher supermarket in Jersey City left three people dead, including two Hasidic Jews, and after an ultra-Orthodox man was stabbed in Muncie on his way to a local synagogue. It says the New York Police Department had already said on Friday that it was stepping up patrols in Jewish neighborhoods in the city after a series of anti-Semitic incidents last week. Can you talk more about the local context of what's been happening?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these attacks are not coming out of nowhere. The Jersey City attack did not come out of nowhere. Over the past year, there have been anywhere from 60 to 90 assaults on Orthodox Jews in the New York area alone. It's absolutely horrifying, and you don't see anybody talking about it. There's been this kind of code of silence around it because it's very hard to understand what's motivating these attacks. You know, in the Pittsburgh massacre and the Poway shooting, it was very clear that these were white supremacists. In this case, a lot of the perpetrators are from the African-American community. Now, of course, this is not the African-American community attacking attacking the Jewish community. It's a bunch of deranged and very, you know, disturbed people and mentally ill people as well. But at the same time, the silence surrounding these attacks, it's left the Jewish community feeling what I call hefker. It's a term from the Talmud, which means up for grabs, like it's open season, like nobody is taking these attacks seriously, which has just resulted in more and more.
Well, who isn't taking these attacks seriously? People are speaking out all over the place.
Yeah, yesterday was actually really moving. For the first time, you saw actually a wellspring of support for the Orthodox community, people speaking up. But, you know, 60 to 90 attacks, right? We don't know the exact number because FOIA requests keep getting rejected.
This is nationally or locally?
This is locally. So if it's the 61st attack and people are speaking up, thank you so much. But where have you been for the last year, the last 2 years? Where has everybody been? There's been that code of silence. Even after Jersey City, people did speak up after Jersey City, but it kind of died down very quickly. Nothing like the wellspring of support that we saw, you know, after Poway and after Pittsburgh. Now, there has been a lot of support from the African-American community. There's been a lot of support from the Muslim community, and that goes such a long way for the Jewish community. And I know that the Orthodox community is hearing it and is appreciating it.
There had been statistics in recent years showing that hate crimes targeted at Jews were rising faster than any other category of hate crimes, but they weren't as visible publicly because most of them were minor vandalism crimes, like as disturbing as they are, not to minimize the scrawling of swastikas or other graffiti. So something has been changing, that these are escalating to actual violence.
Yeah, exactly. So the ADL has found that not only are anti-Semitic attacks rising, but they are getting more violent and more vicious. And, you know, they have been rising over the last 2 years with the Donald Trump presidency, right? And it was very clear what the connection was between President Trump and the Pittsburgh and Poway shooters, because they were repeating the same anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that the president himself sometimes repeats. But I think more generally, you know, President Trump is a conspiracy theorist, and anti-Semitism is often a conspiracy theory about Jewish power. And that has been sort of infiltrating both the right, but also the left, in the way that it's sort of combating the right. There's been a lot of conspiracy theories on the left as well.
And with Batya Unger Sargon, opinion editor at The Forward, also joining us now is Mati Seligson, director of media at Chabad, or the Chabad Lubavitch Hasidic Movement. Mati, Mr. Seligson, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for coming in today. And as I said to Batya, I'm so sorry it's under these circumstances.
Good morning. Thank you, Brian.
Can you put Chabad in the context of the Hasidic or Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox, as it often gets called, community in New York, and put the rabbi whose house it was and the group that was assembled there on Saturday night in the context of the larger community or set of communities?
So there are many Hasidic movements throughout the world and based here in New York. Chabad is one of them. Which is largely – Chabad's based out of Crown Heights in Brooklyn, but there are Chabad communities in Muncie and some of these other areas. And look, the
– Was this Chabad worship that was attacked on Saturday night?
It was not. And – but it was a Hasidic group, and Rabbi Ruttenberg is a Hasidic rabbi and has a Hasidic congregation. And they were in the middle of lighting the Hanukkah candles when they were attacked. And what we're seeing is a lot of people who are Hasidic people who are visibly Jewish, who are being attacked throughout the New York area. Now it's spilled over to New Jersey, out of the county to Rockland County. It's something that everyone's very concerned about.
And listeners, we can take a few phone calls from anybody in any of the local Hasidic communities or anyone else for our guests, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Mati, as you were coming in, Batya was talking about various reasons why this violent wave, and it is a marked increase in violence against Jews in our area relatively recently, as well as nationally, why this might be taking place at this time and at this place.
Well, It's very hard to say. There, you know, people are talking about white nationalism, and there is an issue with white nationalism in this country. That's not the issue that's happening here. In fact, I believe the perpetrators of almost every single attack were other minorities. And perhaps the solution may be not with the police department, which public officials always point at, because we're talking about perceptions here. As opposed to solving crimes and incarcerating people, but it's about education. And if there's one department that may be a solution here, it's the Department of Ed.
Batya, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really beautiful message. I think that of the responses to this attack, Governor Cuomo's has been the worst.
Worst?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't a terrorist attack. This person has schizophrenia, the attacker in Muncie.
And for background for people who haven't heard it, Governor Cuomo has called this an act of domestic terrorism and said one response should be a new domestic terror law that covers crimes like this at the state level.
Yeah, so I think that really missed the mark. I also think that the call for state troopers or more policing, over-policing in these communities that have minority communities in them is problematic. And I've spoken to Orthodox leaders who are sensitive to that, to the way that the police have a complicated relationship with minority communities. I actually think that Mayor de Blasio's response was the best. He suggested that there was going to be a new curriculum in public schools, which I think is exactly like you're saying, an amazing response. He also suggested that there are going to be these new sort of councils and almost community liaisons from both communities, these little groups that are going to walk around the communities, bringing together the Jewish and the Black communities in these urban settings. So I thought that was really powerful.
I asked, it was Dr. Cornell West, and it was Mr. I think his name, first name is Max, I'm not sure, but his last name is Lerner. He's a professor. And he said he was a Jew. And the subject was Blacks and Jews. So I asked a question of both of them. One question I said, with a statement that came before the question, said, I have often heard the expression, Black people, now let me see, I'm trying to remember how I presented it. I said, I have often heard the expression, yes, Black people, white people, and Jews. But I have never heard the expression, Black people, white people, and Christians. Is there any reason, is there any way that anybody can explain why that is? And Dr. Cornell West said, oh, wow. He put his hands up to his temple, I mean, you know, and then he just looked at the ceiling and he didn't say nothing else. So it was a long pause, so I didn't think he was going to say nothing else, so. And I said, well, Dr. Lerner, I said, do you have an answer to that? And he said, I pass. And I said, thank you very much, gentlemen. And I sat down. See, I don't argue. When I ask a question, I mean, I just listen to the answer. The answer from Dr. West was, oh, wow. The answer from Dr. Lerner was, I pass.
Hasidic Jews in New York are on edge following the stabbing last weekend at a Hanukkah party in the town of Muncie. Five people were injured, one critically. Governor Andrew Cuomo says, all told, there were more than a dozen anti-Semitic incidents reported statewide last month. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann spent time with one Hasidic family in Brooklyn. They say their community faces growing hatred, and it's coming at them from different directions.
It's a chilly night in the Williamsburg neighborhood, the streets busy with Hasidic families coming and going, the men and boys wearing distinctive hats and beards and side curls known as payas.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. I'm Brian Mann.
Yeah, nice to see you.
Esther Weiss and her husband Yehuda have lived here all their lives. Inside, their street-level home is bright. Yehuda pours me a glass of orange juice while Esther sets out a tray of sugared nuts. But they quickly turn to the reason for my visit.
We all get worried and scared.
It's very scary, and it's putting a lot of stress on our daily lives.
Hasidic Jews started moving to Williamsburg in the 1930s, and the community's population now tops 70,000. There are traditional schools, kosher shops, and synagogues. Esther says it was a great place to grow up.
We were always sheltered and felt comfortable living easily, happily, without any fears. But these instances are rising tremendously faster than we could decide what we're supposed to do with our lives now.
This is still one of the safest neighborhoods in New York, but recent anti-Semitic incidents have shaken people here. It ranges from harassment and bullying to the full-blown violence of the machete attack in Monsey, just north of the city. There was also a deadly attack last month against a kosher market across the river in Jersey City, New Jersey. Yehuda says it's especially frightening for Hasidic Jews whose traditional clothing and hair mark them as targets.
I never thought of having weapons by me to defend myself because I don't feel that it's a good thing that everybody should have guns or any weapons at all. But now I'm really thinking they should have a bottle of mace at least in your pocket.
I ask why they think this is happening. Why this apparent increase in aggression against Jews? They say it seems to be coming from a lot of different directions. First, from white supremacists.
It almost sounds like the Nazis are picking their heads up again. My parents were both Holocaust survivors and they're still alive. They're here to tell the stories. But we thought here in New York, it's a story of the past. It's not going to happen here.
But the Weisses say they're worried about threats and harassment from almost everybody. Some of the most violent incidents in recent weeks, including the Monsey attack, allegedly involved African-American suspects, not white supremacists. The Weisses say they have good relations with many of their black neighbors, but they make their living as landlords, renting apartments. They used to collect rents in person. Now they try not to.
We always used to go down to the buildings, to the properties to check up. We're scared to go. You don't know what's going to happen. They're going to see a Jewish guy here. They're going to find the target. So we're not going. We're doing by phone, by email, as much as we can.
While we talk, Esther and Yehuda's son, Laser, comes in and sits listening.
I'm turning 12 the next month.
Laser's always been what you might call a free-range kid, walking to school, running errands in the neighborhood at all hours. But with his smaller set of side curls, he too is clearly identifiable as Hasidic. He says he feels vulnerable.
Sure. Scary thing. We are talking.
Kids share scary stories, Laser says. There are security posts outside their schools, and they've been holding live shooter drills. He says it makes him anxious.
Coming home, I see a white car go fast, and I turn around. I see it's opening the door.
I started running.
Laser's mom no longer lets him go out after dark. The Weisses blame a lot of this anti-Semitism on the internet.
Because this, what you're seeing, saluting and the swastikas drawn all over, graves being attacked, it's just what's seeping out. But what's going on underneath?
Should be closed, such internet sites. That's very terrible they leave it open because that goes to a lot of people in 1 minute.
Officials say they are stepping up police patrols to restore a sense of security to Jewish neighborhoods. But the Weisses say for now, things feel like they're getting worse, not better. Brian Mann, NPR News, Brooklyn.
New York. New York. New York.
And starting on New Year's Day, a slate of criminal justice reforms passed this past spring will go into effect in New York State. A major one, the elimination of cash bail. The new law says judges can no longer set bail for most nonviolent crimes. If the new law had been in place last year, for example, 20,000 defendants would have not gone to jail in New York City alone. Also coming January 1st, I should say, are new laws having to do with evidentiary sharing. No longer will prosecutors be able to withhold evidence that might help the defense until the day of the trial. While some are rejoicing about these reforms, district attorneys and some other politicians say the changes will lead to more crime and will cost the state time and money. With me now is WNYC senior reporter Beth Fertig. She's been reporting on the changes soon to come as we talk about what's actually going to change on New Year's Day with respect to bail and how's it going to affect people. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So let's say I'm charged with stealing a backpack. The new law says judges must now consider the least restrictive condition necessary to ensure I return. What are the options under the new law?
Well, first of all, if it's a misdemeanor charge, under the current law, most likely you'd be released with just come back to court on your own recognizance. In fact, 90% of misdemeanors in Brooklyn, for example, are released on their own recognizance already. Under the new law, what happens is all misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies are not eligible for bail. But depending on the circumstances, the prosecutors and the judges can decide that they want to have release with supervision if they think that the person is not likely to come back to court unless they're given reminders. Because in New York, it's not about whether you're dangerous. That's not the factor for setting bail. It's about your risk of flight, which, of course, there can be a bit of a charade around this, and you can set very high bail for somebody accused of serious charges, which sounds like it's really about the danger. But technically in New York, it's about your risk of flight. So under the new law, they can do supervised release, which occurs already in New York City, but it's being expanded a lot right now to cover people accused of misdemeanors, nonviolent felonies, and even a violent felony if the judge thinks that's the right thing to do.
And so this stat that I read, if you think it's accurate, 20,000 defendants would have not gone to jail in New York City in the last year alone if this new bail law was in effect. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that's the John Jay research group came up with that. And they looked at the defendants going through the city over the course of the year 2018. And they said that of these people who wound up in Rikers because they couldn't make bail, that's the number that would not have had to face bail at all under the new law.
And I'm sure some people picked up that I used the example of stealing a backpack. And that, of course,
right,
is a reference to the petty crime that resulted in 20-year-old Khalif Browder spending 3 years in jail because he couldn't afford bail, and he ultimately killed himself.
Right.
So as a criminal justice reporter, how big a deal are these reforms, do you think, in terms of how much it will transform or lessen the jail population, especially at Rikers?
It's supposed to have a dramatic effect on the bail population, and it's one reason why in closing Rikers, they're estimating that there will only be, you know, less than 4,000 people in jail in the next 6 or 7 years, and the plan for closing Rikers is to replace it with 4 smaller jails, jails that will not accommodate as many people but spread out more across 4 of the boroughs. And yeah, certainly there will be fewer people going to jail because they can't make bail. And that was the goal of the reform, was that two people charged with the same crime, one rich, one poor, the rich person would be able to bail themselves out, and the poor person would be waiting there, like Khalif Browder, for years potentially, because it can take a really long time for a case to go to trial if they want to go to trial.
Beth, there's an issue of of a rearrest in the news. Can you talk about that?
Right. So the defendant, Tiffany Harris, who was one of the people arrested in a spate of anti-Semitic attacks, she was arrested and released after allegedly assaulting 3 women in Brooklyn, Orthodox Jewish women. And in that case, there was a bit of an uproar over the weekend that she had been released on her own recognizance. And then yesterday, she was rearrested. Now, I want to just explain a little bit what's going on with that case. So I reached out to the Brooklyn DA's office, and they told me that they did not ask for any release with supervision, which they could have done in that case for a woman who was technically it's a nonviolent felony, although I believe they bumped it up to technically it was a misdemeanor because she didn't actually seriously hurt the people, although that's a horrible crime. And they can bump it up to an E felony, which is the lowest form of felony, a nonviolent felony technically, again, because she didn't strike the people seriously and cause a lot of harm. But under the new law, if you're charged with a nonviolent felony or even a misdemeanor, the prosecutor can ask for release with supervision, which, again, it's not because you're a danger to the community. It's because of a risk of flight. There's an algorithm that the city uses so that the judges and the prosecutors see the person's past criminal history. And in this case, she does have one. In fact, she didn't show up for a court appearance quite recently. And so that judge could have set release conditions and chose not to, and I don't know why. Now that she's been rearrested, if she had been rearrested on a felony, a very serious charge, they could automatically have asked for bail for her. However, I believe it's another misdemeanor. I believe she allegedly struck somebody, but not seriously enough for it to be a felony. So it's complicated because the other thing I'm told is that the charges that she's accused of, 90% of the time, people in Brooklyn are released already on their own recognizance on those types of charges. I was looking at data from the Criminal Justice Agency, and it's interesting because citywide, the percent of cases in which they ask for money bail has been going down dramatically over the years. It was something like 43% in 1987, and last year it was just 23% of cases was their money bail. And if you look at Brooklyn, where these cases occurred, for misdemeanors, 90% of the time there was no request for bail. For nonviolent felonies, which would be something similar to what Ms. Harris was charged with, 61% of the time there was no request for bail. So it's not like it's a dramatic change for certain offenses, but for other offenses, yes. They will not be asking for bail. It's not even an option. So they can ask for release with supervision, which, again, it's not because they're considered dangerous, because that's not part of our law. And that's the reason why many politicians, including the mayor and the governor, want danger to be a factor, like it is in New Jersey, where there's no bail at all. But a judge can say, I want to hold this person because I consider them dangerous. The argument in New York was that people feared that that would penalize people of color who are more likely to have criminal records because of their contact with police.
And earlier in the hour, we were talking about the anti-Semitic attack up in Muncie, New York, and you quoted the mayor on Twitter who said this about anti-Semitic attacks and bail reform, quote, "We think the impulse behind bail reform is a good one, but that legislation needs to be improved to protect the rights of judges to have flexibility to hold someone in when they present a danger to the community." Is that Mayor de Blasio?
Yes. Yeah, he did say that yesterday when asked about the bail laws. And this is what I think we're going to be hearing a lot of in the coming days and weeks as the new legislative session starts, because there are prosecutors and politicians who want danger to be a factor. And they're going to say that when you see what's happening now with defendants being released, that we should have more ways for judges to have discretion. And there are hundreds of cases now in which judges cannot consider bail when they used to before. And there's many different arguments about this on all sides, whether there were mistakes and maybe some charges should have been bail eligible that are no longer bail eligible. But the case in Muncie, that individual was charged, is being held on bail. So that would have happened regardless. And, you know, that is not affected because in violent crimes, you can still ask for bail.
Also this morning, Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, said this on CNN.
I feel very strongly about criminal justice reform. And we've talked about things like, you know, and you've seen politicians like Governor Cuomo talk about bail reform, which is really important. If you jump a turnstile or you shoplift a pack of chewing gum, I'm not sure bail is the most important thing. But if you brutalize a person because of the way they pray, if you attack an individual because of where they're from, that should not be something where you're immediately getting released without bail.
So I think you just said the perpetrator in the Muncie attack, the alleged perpetrator, is being held without
yes.
bail because of the nature of the crime. So that's
no, on bail, I believe. Bail was asked.
Sorry, I meant held with bail.
Yes.
Forgive me. Because of the violent nature of the attack. So the issue of the bail reform law, at least in that case, would not apply.
Exactly.
But in the case you were talking about before, then there was an issue.
Yeah, these cases in Brooklyn where there have been people slugging, punching, assaulting Orthodox Jewish community members, those people who have been released, and in fact, in one case, the person was released with supervision after allegedly hitting a woman with a handbag in Brooklyn. That person was sent for release with supervision on a bi-monthly basis. They have to check in with a mental health agency in Long Island. And proponents of this supervised release system say it doesn't do the defendants any good to be held in Rikers on bail that they can't afford or in some cases can't afford, and then they're sprung anyway. The point is to ensure that they come back to court and use that as an opportunity to get them – to give them services that can address their underlying issues. And so maybe that's a good thing that this person, instead of being held on Rikers on some bail that she could not afford, will get mental health treatment. That there is an argument for that. And this other individual who was released on her own recognizance and then allegedly reoffended yesterday by assaulting someone, maybe that person should have been released with some supervision, somebody to check in with, somebody to make sure that she was not going to cause future problems. Although, again, the only purpose of the law is to make sure they come back to court. Now, what she was charged with yesterday, I have a feeling is not a felony, so she will not be eligible for bail now, but I'm sure that with all the scrutiny on this case, the Brooklyn DA's office may ask for a release with supervision and some conditions.
For a cop, as good as I, a Brooklyn guy, been drinking crooked eye. Don't resist a pudding pie. You think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
New at 5, there are some calls tonight for the NYPD commissioner to fire an officer convicted of bursting into an African-American woman's home and threatening her in a drunken rage. In court, Officer Michael Reynolds admitted to kicking in the woman's door and using a racial slur. This all happened during a booze-soaked bachelor party in Nashville. News 4's Chris Glorioso is live at the 33rd Precinct, where the cop is on modified duty now. And Chris, a protest just wrapped up there this afternoon.
That's right. The protesters gathered at police headquarters and they implored the new NYPD Commissioner Dermot Shea to swiftly terminate Officer Reynolds. And they said the crimes he admitted to in Tennessee are equivalent to bias crimes. After all, they say he admitted to breaking into a black woman's home and in that drunken rage using racist language.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
About 24 protesters gathered on New Year's Day to demand the NYPD terminate Officer Michael Reynolds, a 26-year-old cop who admitted in Nashville court to a terrifying crime. In July of 2018, he said he was blackout drunk when he broke into an African-American woman's home and threatened her. A neighbor's security camera caught this audio of Reynolds' intoxicated tirade. The homeowner, Conice Halliburton, said the off-duty cop followed that up with a racial slur.
What we did not see were charges of bias crimes. When some reports indicate that he used the N-word.
At his sentencing, Officer Reynolds said he was so drunk, he mistakenly thought the house was the Airbnb where he was staying two doors down. He said he had no recollection of using a racial slur, but when an attorney asked him, if you did use that type of word or the specific word that was referred to, what do you say to the victim and this court? I'm absolutely sorry I said that word, said Reynolds. I'm very remorseful. It's cost me my job, my life, everything.
This happened to people in Tennessee, but we here in New York are standing for and with them.
Do you believe this was a hate crime committed by Officer Reynolds?
It sure sounds like it. I would submit this. Hate crime or not, there was a crime that occurred, and we could all agree on this. That crime should mean that you are no longer a member of the NYPD.
Representatives for Officer Reynolds could not be reached today. Reynolds isn't the only one protesters are calling for to be fired. Remember, he was at a bachelor party with two other off-duty cops, and there are allegations that at least one of those officers tried to use his status as law enforcement to influence the complaint process. More on that coming up at 6. For now, reporting live at the 33rd Precinct, Chris Glorioso, News 4, New York.
Call that unjust networking. That's what they call that. Unjust networking. See, I'm a enforcement officer. You see my badge? We can cover this one up. What's the metaphor? Let's go on and sweep this one under the rug. Yeah, we're fellow officers. Come on. Look out for your brother. Your brother in blue. Unjust networking. Context of white supremacy. Why wasn't that an act of domestic terrorism? Officer Reynolds out of jurisdiction down in Tennessee. Just asking questions. Compensatory call in. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 4, 2020. Whew, if you have questions, comments, you have your own examples of unjust networking, the number to dial, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A few things before we get to our listeners. Cows, 2020 Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, Toronto. Get your passport, talking to Gus T included. Get your passport. That is one reason, and there are many, why Toronto was selected for the next city. But motivating victims of racism to get their passport. I've heard other victims talk about perhaps relocating to the continent, or at least visiting at some point. Having a passport might be handy for that sort of endeavor. I've heard some of our listeners talk about going to Japan with their offspring, or making other travel arrangements to get out and do things. Fantastic. Universal man, universal woman. Sounds like a passport might be helpful in that process. And you never know. Racists make it difficult if you don't have identification at times. And then sometimes they make it really difficult to get identification. You just never know. It might become more expensive to get a passport or anything. If you get the booklet, I think that is good for a decade. So it is a good document to have. And you never know. Even beyond the Cows Yoga Retreat, some other opportunities might present themselves. Like, hey, passport. And it's just another valuable piece of documentation. Passport generally is good anywhere your regular ID would be valid. Anywho, but the dates for Toronto, May 21 through May 24th. The cost, $660. Make it accessible. And we had a number of parents who said they would like to bring their offspring. They would like to make sure it's accessible. I think we can accommodate, as long as we have 8 paying adults, $660. Any offspring 14 years and under, $330. That would be half price, $330. As long as we have 8 paying adults, you would have to share a bed with your offspring. I don't think that's asking too much if it's your child. You've probably done so before. Let's see. The deposit would be February 29th. $400, not refundable. The remaining $260, May 1. That would, the deposit and all would be available if you are paying for your offspring as well. So you could do half of $330. Unless my math is bad, that is $165. And then the remaining $165 for May 1st. All of this will be written out, just not that far removed from Florida, but all this will be written down so you can read it at your leisure. But 660, May 21 through May 24th, Toronto. And just a general FYI, I was looking to make this later, like summertime, because Toronto in the summertime is amazing. And apparently white people know that because it is astronomically more expensive to do this retreat like August. Same day, like to do a four-day, three-night retreat at the same location in Toronto would be about double the price to do it in the summertime, because lots of people apparently know that, wow, Toronto is amazing in the summertime. But it's pretty nice in late spring, too. So May 21 through May 24, you can email for questions, comments. I will make sure that I nag about this the whole way through. We will have our counter-racist yoga retreat recap from the Florida event in a couple of days. Once I have fully acclimated to being back and have a free spot on the schedule and can touch base with everyone, talk to everyone, we will recount details from Florida to make sure it's worth your while. I do think it is beneficial, health and wellness, eating well, trying to eat correctly, sleep correctly, exchanging views on racism, white supremacy, and being in an environment where you can hopefully have a courteous and nourishing exchange with other victims of racism, I think is helpful towards establishing justice, universal man, universal woman. So we'll talk about what happened in Florida, why there is a benefit to all of this, and why maybe you should think about coming to hang out May 21 to May 24th in Toronto. We'll have delicious food. Sweet potato pie might be a staple at the yoga retreats. We'll have to see. Delicious food, a little bit of yoga, gun range. We have been to the gun range at all of the Cal's yoga retreats, or we have done shooting. We didn't necessarily go to the gun range, but we have been engaged in shooting at every Cal's yoga retreat. Canada is gun country, I have been told, so they call it. So we might be able to continue that trend north of the U.S. border. More details to come. Continuing, we are listener-supported. Counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the Cows is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. Address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. We are listener-supported. You will see the PayPal button in the top right corner. In addition to PayPal, we are on Cash App. You can visit the address. It is cash.app/$TheCows. Enormous gratitude to all the folks who have invested via PayPal, Cash App over the last decade plus, almost 11 years. I hope the Cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also drop an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. Again, enormous thanks to everyone who has invested in the Cows. You can also support via our wish list at Amazon.com. It is listed under Gus T. Renegade. I hope the Cows has been worthy of everyone's time, energy, and support. I hope we have provided accurate, consistent, constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what we can do to solve this problem immediately. Wow, what a long list of things to share. I had to write out a list. There were so many things. Or I guess number one, if people have questions about the retreat, either Florida, what happened, or Toronto, either or, that is fine. But in terms of retreat recap, I'd prefer, because we'll have a whole program for folks can share their views and say a word or two. I can share a thought or two myself on the retreat. I think that would be awesome. The only portion I will share now, share this now or wait till later? I'll have to give it some thought. I had thought, oh, yes, I'll share. But then if we're going to have a retreat program, it's just a matter of when to share. So I'll take a moment to think about that. I'll go down the rest of my list in the meantime. Lengthy it is. Number one, 51,000 accounts restored in Seattle, Washington, where they vanquished library fees, late fees, that is. You're still charged for late books. So many things were fascinating about that segment. I've said for years, nearly bragging as though I own the libraries or something, that they have so many libraries, literally dozens of libraries within Seattle proper, and that's not even counting the King County Library System with all its additional branches. That's a whole separate entity. So you have all of that. We played the segment before, just last year, where they talked about how they exclusively booted out black children, not black and brown children, not children of color, just black children get kicked out of the Seattle public libraries. We did that big segment from last year. Dr. Welsing and all of her dialogue about reading being more important than watching television. They don't have very many black people in Seattle, and whammo, they do away with the fees. And you even have the white woman who did the report for KUOW, Seattle's public radio, who said, hey, I annually have about $100 in library fees, and whammo, now I got an extra $100 to waste at Starbucks or, you know, whatever else. But imagine then, they said the number of children who had their accounts restored, and they said, what did they say here? They put the tacky vernacular on it. They said, low opportunity neighborhoods. What in the, I thought it was urban environment. They got so many names for this is the dilapidated area where we put the niggers. Why don't you just say that? They come out with a new one about every 5 years. It'll be urban areas, disadvantaged areas, economically deprived areas. They just come out, they just keep them going. They have somebody, that's their job. You just crank out these phrases and we'll just keep using them. Just where we warehouse the niggers, that'll be fine. Thank you. Now everybody is clear about what we're talking about. Listen, just from that segment alone, they said that they generate about $1 million from library fees annually. They looked at the 2018 budget, and for me, what was significant was they said, so it's not that much. $1 million is not that much for the Seattle Public Library budget. And they talked about the levies that they got. White people in this area, they know Dr. Welsing, a genius. Reading is more important than Netflix and Hulu and the playoffs. Read. We don't need your $100. Keep your raggedy $100. Read. We need white, literate race soldiers. They know the value of reading. Dr. Welsing, read. $1 million isn't even anything to our budget. Now, how many of you all live in a city that can say that about your public library system? Even Thomas in New York. I would challenge any of you all. $1 million is nothing to your city budget. Or they did say it was significant, but it's not that much. Not, hey, we can wipe that off the books. No problem. No, you can take that out of the budget. We don't need that $1 million. Keep it. We'll be fine. Not closing any branches down at all. Seattle, easily the best plantation I have been to. Toronto is close. Let's see. The publishing, racism in the romance publishing industry. I'm so thankful that they included it in the NPR segment. Al Jazeera did a report, maybe at the last 2020, it was maybe 4 years ago at this point, but they did a report and they were talking about racism in the publishing industry, publishing books talking about. And they said that unlike what we generally hear, the man, not in the publishing industry. They said in the publishing industry, we are overwhelmingly, and they put numbers on it. We're talking like 77% of the people who are in charge of who gets a book published and who does not. You are talking about white women, not the man. Racist woman is responsible for the book. And I mean, as important as books are, that is, wow, that does not sound like a weakling on the plantation. Anyway, they included that in the NPR segment on the racism and the romance industry, that this is white women who are in charge of this billion-dollar conglomerate. What they said, that's the most profitable portion of the publishing industry, even though they say it's not respected. We make the money. Mr. Fuller talked about all those books with the heaving breasts and a sword and a blonde this and that. White women are in charge of that. No surprise there at all. Their holiday is coming up. February is fast approaching. I saw they went by the time I left Seattle and they had Christmas decorations up. When I came back, they had the chocolate hearts in the store. Romance. But wasn't it so tacky? They didn't penalize the white woman who was accused of practicing racism. They took punitive action against the non-white female who said, you offended us by accusing us of practicing racism. We're going to offend and we are going to suspend and silence you, and you will have no more leadership roles. And then when they came back, if you pay attention to the language, they said, well, oh, now that people are upset about this, well, we changed our mind for the time being. Now, whites with, when they use language like that, sometimes what will happen is while everyone is upset about it and everyone is paying attention to this right now, oh my goodness, let's put, you know, the little colored woman back up there. Okay, fine. All right. And then they'll wait until June when people are focused on, you know, other things. Maybe O.J. Simpson is back in the news or whatever. They're not paying attention. Well, they said for the time being, after further investigation, we're going to go ahead and suspend you again and hope that people just don't pay attention this time, or we can move on. We'll have 6 months to get our strategy together for how we're going to, you know, spin and write this up. Next. Man, the yoga retreat. One thing that I will say. It was significant in a very pleasant manner. When the shooting happened at White Settlement, Texas, and I thought it was important, they said that the shooting happened, they named the church, but they said Fort Worth, Texas. When we at the yoga retreat in Florida saw this news report, they said this happened at a church in White Settlement, Texas. And we immediately said, wow, that name, like, that has literally white supremacy racism written all over it, literally. And we were there. We had Wi-Fi at the retreat this time, so we were immediately able to begin doing research. And it was so harmonious to be amongst victims of racism and to just be together on a Sunday afternoon, relaxing. We had just had tasty, nutritious veggie meal. We had done yoga outside in the rain that morning. And then things erupt at White Settlement, Texas. And we actually took time out immediately and began to research the history of white supremacy racism in the town and the shooting incident. It was amazing. And in fact, it even continued when the second time we went to the gun range. Say that one again. So the second time we went to the gun range at the Florida counter-racist yoga retreat, the instructor, suspected race soldier, he knew all about the church shooting incident. He had identified the weapons being used and the errors made by the gunman security team member who was shot. Wow, I will have a lot more to say about that when we do the retreat recap. But the White Settlement, Texas shooting, I thought it was significant that they didn't name the town where this happened. And I thought it was significant that they mentioned repeatedly, like, wow, this fella came in and he sat amongst the congregation members and he hung out with them and talked to one of the members for him. And then he got up and began shooting them. Like, doesn't that just make it even, I mean, wow, that's just, it's just even more heinous to even think about. And they kept saying, and I thought, wow, I thought we've heard this before. A white shooter coming into a church and sitting down with the parishioners before killing the members. It just sounds so familiar. You telling me that nobody at NPR remembers Dylann Roof? Nobody at NPR thought, wow, maybe this shooter, maybe he was influenced by Dylann Roof. Maybe that's where he got this idea from. Maybe he saw that and wanted to, what they say, copycat. Isn't that the metaphor? That didn't occur, even though they mentioned it repeatedly. Continuing, When they had the report on the attacks in New York about anti-Semitism being on the rise, they said no one is taking these attacks seriously. I'm not sure how one would qualify that. I've heard people, many folks, government officials, powerful white people from all ranks in many different geographic locations address any time there has been a shooting, a major incident of violence against someone who is classified as a Jew or Jewish. Democracy Now, I think that's a major platform. They've done a number of reports, and even very recently, before, not just in the past couple of days, I mean within the past 2 to 3 months before some of these recent events happened, they had been talking about this. I do not think that's accurate at all. In my view, some of the times one of their standard tactics is for white people to claim that they are victims. And that'll be a part of it, that we're victims and this has been happening and nobody has been paying attention. That happens with the so-called white LGBTQI, and you just keep adding letters, individuals as well. They continued with that segment. They were talking to the child who said he was Jewish, someone who I would suspect might be also white. And they said that they had security posts at the schools to make sure that they were safe. I cannot remember in any time in the past almost 11 years that the cows has been on the air, out of all the incidents that have happened to black people, black children, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown Jr., insert the name, when they had officers slammed down in South Carolina. I can't think of any incident where afterwards the result was they had security at a black school to make sure that the black children felt safe. If you can remember that incident, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943#. Press *61 if you remember. I do not. I can think of a whole lot of incidents where as a result it was, we're going to have enforcement. We need an extra officer slam at the school. Because these young niggers might be out of control and things might get out of hand. That's the metaphor that they'll say. Make sure things don't get out of hand. You know, you got to keep an eye on the niggers. Not we need to keep them safe and make sure that, you know, no one is trying to harm them. Get your pepper spray at the ready. 3 o'clock, they'll be out. Pepper spray at the ready. Let's see. And in the same segment, exactly the opposite, they talked about having increased patrols in the areas where black people live, even though they said that one of the attackers, the black fella, had a mental disorder. It wasn't that this guy had on Nazi paraphernalia and said, I'm going out to kill so-called Jews. They said this person had a mental disorder. Why would that be? And she even said that doesn't count as a terrorist attack. This is someone with mental problems. Well, if that's the case, then why do we need to increase patrols at all? Why not get more mental health services? Even the way that they reported the attack with the black fella, they said that this suspect had a machete the size of a broom. Let me give out that number again. 605-313-5164. I have not seen a machete that was the size of a broom. Now, I understand that there are smaller brooms. I've seen brooms that, you know, are a foot. They're really tiny ones, you know. The standard broom that I think of is more than 3 feet tall. I generally don't think I have ever seen a machete that was the size of a broom. That's something where I don't. This is the program we say no metaphors for reasons like that. It, particularly if it's going to be something that even sounds like, dangerous niggers, black identity extremists, something that's going to justify mistreatment of black people. I would like things to be specific, exact details, no metaphors, because then we start, are we lying here? Are we giving out false information that's just going to be used to justify mistreating black people? Because racists do that all the time. Just give me the dimensions. If you use the machete, you got it, right? This person's in custody, right? What are the dimensions? You could tell me. Was it 3 feet? Was it 10 feet? Was it 8 feet? We would know Exactly. You could even give me a picture. I'm a broke black person and I got a phone. I could take a picture. Give me a photograph. That way we'll know the exact dimensions. Don't tell me it was the size of a broom unless you're going to give me a photograph next to a broom. Continuing. They said in that same segment, talk about power relationship. They said, oh my goodness, all of these attacks, we're afraid of the Negros. My goodness. A lot of us are landlords. Now that right there, power dynamic. I'm the landlord. These are the tenants. And it sounded like some of these people didn't just have one property, that they probably had multiple properties. So if you're in that secure of a financial position, there's probably a substantial financial difference between you as a landlord and the folks that you are renting to. But you're afraid. What are they going to do exactly? Has there been any history of these Negro tenants being unruly? They put you in the headlock. They refuse to pay their rent and threaten violence against you if you give them any lip about it. What I say about playing the victim role? We're terrified. We got to do everything by email. We don't want to talk to the Negroes. They're afraid. You just get lots of these segments. I don't see with white people and all of the terrorist acts that they engage in. Dylann Roof, that white teenager, 16-year-old, who was influenced by Dylann Roof in Georgia, who was going out to do the same terrorist act. I don't hear people come on and say, oh, my goodness, I'm just afraid of white people. I just can't do it. I try to cut off as much contact as possible. If I can do it by email, if I can mail all my packages online and everything, anything I can do to minimize contact with white people, that's what I do. Did you see that Dylann Roof fellow on television? My goodness, I get shingles every time I see his photograph. Where are those reports at? You get reports about these, about black people, all the time. Scary, but it doesn't matter if it's talking about a black 5-year-old, a black 90-year-old. It's always scary black people, and that'll be justified for some sort of mistreatment of the Negro. I also want to add, I thought that was a super important segment for Mr. Fuller talking about so-called Jews. I thought Sammy Davis Jr., classified as black, Negro in some circles, I thought he was Jewish or a Jew. I thought Alice Walker's daughter, Rebecca Walker, that's a cowbell, classified as non-white, and I think she's classified as so-called Jewish. We've had black people on the program who identify as Jewish who reside in the area of the world known as Israel. They're talking as though everybody unilaterally who is classified as Jewish is not black, is classified as white, and that's not true at all. You would have some people who would be black Jewish, so they would be suspected of being anti-Semitic or whatever other term that they want to use, and they're classified as Jewish or Jew. Promotion of confusion. Confusion. End with the metaphors, because there were many. American cancer that was used in the Jewish segment. Machete the size of a broom. Nazis are picking their heads up again. It was quite a few. I tried to write them down as we were moving. It was quite a few of the metaphors, consistently racist. They will use analogies, comparisons, similes to generate confusion. Frequently, they will take two separate concepts and insist that they are identical, exact same thing. And frequently, that is not the case at all. Victims of white supremacy, myself included, we've been exposed to this misconduct for decades, centuries, and many of us, we are still learning. As such, we do not always have conclusions and or logic on certain topics, which is fine, but it just means that sometimes we will substitute an analogy or comparison for logic. Many times that produces more confusion. If we can make an effort to be precise, exact with what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. If you need more time to form your thoughts, that is always supported. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your views, that'll make sure everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you have additional questions, comments, grand, just make sure that everyone has spoken at least once, and then you can rejoin for additional comments, questions. Also, if you could make sure you could use your mute button, just to make sure we don't have unnecessary disruptions to the broadcast. If you know you're in a noisy environment, people are watching the playoff game or they're still celebrating 2020 and all, use your mute button. Then if you can get to a relatively quiet area, you can speak up, share your thoughts, and then mute again. Just helps preserve the audio quality of the broadcast. Let's see. Share now about the retreat. Wait till later. So indecisive. Think. Let me give out the number. 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I'll share my one bit now. This will be my one that I'll share for the retreat. And really, I'm just sharing this to make sure I do not get embarrassed later on. At least I can share it, so it'll be for me, and then nobody can, what they call it, blackmail me as we move forward. So every time, or at least thus far, the two retreats we've had, Virginia and Florida, I always have at least one incident of some goofiness with the plane. I think I said on Thursday, every time I leave Seattle, I'm reminded anew of how far Seattle is from everything. And I think the metaphor analogy that I presented in almost a very literal fashion, I feel like I live in a cave up in the mountains. And for the retreats, it's like I get to come down and visit the townspeople. And then I go back up into the mountains. That's literally how it feels. So I think Virginia, I talked about, I felt like I was going to die, and all of that's in the archives, the difficulty of getting there and getting back and the whole nine. This time around, it was not that bad. I guess you can, well, I think the thing they call it a learning curve, as you are still learning, but you get better. You know, as you continue to practice and you continue to do things, you will see improvements. So, you know, maybe the first time around riding a bicycle, maybe you fell five times. You come back the next time, oh, maybe you only fall three times. You come back around the third time, maybe you only fall once. Learning, you get a little bit better. So this time, it was not as bad as Virginia, but there was still a spot of ugliness right at the end. And it was directly related to Virginia. When we were in Virginia, one of the things, and when I did the survey after the Virginia retreat, they said water. I was dehydrated. And Gusty was dehydrated as well. They did have water, but I guess it was just a problem of getting it to people or folks knowing where to access it or whatever it was. But lots of dehydration in Virginia. Gus T, being easily the person who has traveled furthest for all of the retreats, was dehydrated getting to Virginia on the plane was dehydrated getting to Virginia, and then a little bit dehydrated getting back, but not as bad. So this time I'm thinking in advance, not going to be thirsty on that long plane ride. It takes like a good 6 hours or so to get back. I'm drinking water in advance Wednesday morning, getting my fluids up, so I will be good. Thought I used the restroom. We leave, retired firefighter, gracious enough to lug myself and Chef Nadir, lug us to the airport. We're getting down the road, and we start out thinking, oh no, I got to go to the bathroom. But I've got that long flight. I don't want to miss it. I know it's going to probably be crowded at the Orlando airport on New Year's Day. So let's just shove off. I'll use the bathroom at the airport. So we're chugging along. Boom, 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 boom. An hour's passed. I've been holding it, which is, you know, horrible. You should go answer nature's call. That's what Dr. Rossian said on the broadcast. And we're almost at the airport, but I feel like I'm about to die. And I'm not sure if I can make it to the airport or not. Feel like I'm literally going to die. So you know what? We're going to have to stop. We pull over, and I'm like, literally, just let me pull over on the side of the road. We don't have to get to an exit. Just want to use the restroom really quick and get to the airport so I do not miss that lengthy flight back to Seattle. We pull over. I'm going to run on the side of the road. People that have not been to Florida, they do have swamps, literally. We're not at the swamp, but we're close enough that I can see it. I think I'm standing on firm ground. I'm standing at the tip of the swamp where there's mud. The ground begins to sink, and my foot is sinking rapidly. It's sinking so quick, I actually think I'm going to lose my shoe. And I end up falling to the ground. I fall to the ground. I catch myself, do my yoga, catch myself. I get back up. get my shoe out of the mud, shake off all the excess dirt, hop back into the vehicle, and we take off. Within 5 seconds, I'm like, wait a minute, where's my phone? Because that's where I have my boarding ticket. Where's my phone? Ring it, no answer. I'm like, did my phone fall when, you know, I was felled by the Florida swamp mud? And sure enough, so we have to swing around again. Retired firefighter, what a gentleman, victim of racism, putting up with a klutz like myself. He swings back around, go through the exit, trump back down. I find my phone. We troop back to the airport. I'm super nervous and anxious, like, oh my God, I'm going to miss my flight. And I'm literally thousands of miles, and, you know, I'm going to be stuck down here in Florida in the swamp. And thankfully, we get to the airport. I have a positive experience with TSA and air traffic. The employees of Orlando International Airport, they move me ahead of the TSA line. I was easily able to make my flight. I'm back in Seattle safe and sound, but that did happen. The moral of the story, pee before you go. Whew. Hopefully we will not have any other stories like that. And I forgot, retired firefighter did all that, and then he threatened to blackmail me by saying, give me $20 and I will not share that story on the compensatory call. And I said, oh my God, he would do that to me after all these years. And I said, I have to make sure I share this one, because he was not the only person to witness this. And I said, someone at some point might decide to do that. So I have to make sure that I share so we can all get our giggle in, and then nobody can blackmail me, as they say, down the road. But the moral to the story, again, pee before you go. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hey, Gus, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing? Victim out of New Jersey. Real fast, the I too, my family, grandmother's side, paternal side, identify as Jews, and they are black. Late great grandfather was a rabbi, just to, you know, add to that. The lady who assaulted the Jewish people, I'm thinking that's New York City, and she was arrested and charged with a hate crime and then released and assaulted somebody else. I think if she was white, she would have the presumption of not being mentally having some type of mental problems. It seems a rush to charge these black people within the last few incidents involving black people and Jewish people with hate crimes. I'm not sure why they're doing this. You know, but it's interesting, and I've been paying attention to it. Even with the shooting in Jersey City, with the labeled, and the shooters are labeled as Black Hebrew Israelites. From what I believe, the Israelites identify themselves as Jews, also. In New York City, with the incidents that, you know, happened, with this woman who I do believe, is mentally ill, I work in New York, and there is a large number of homeless, mentally ill people that I see regularly, walking around the city. So, you know, I just, you know, I don't really know what to make of this, but I'm just, you know, I've been taking notes of late when I hear news reports, because, you know, news, you know, sometimes they report the news and they change up the story. So I just take mental notes. I pay attention to the language. Yeah, right now that's all I have.
Much obliged. That is important in terms of, that's, you know, one of the reasons why consistently playing news reports on this program, hoping that people get better at processing information, so-called news, evaluating, and then noting those inconsistencies. What you said, sometimes things don't get reported consistently, much less accurately in the news, or just noticing idiosyncrasies and how different outlets report material. Very important. And just Dr. Welsing talked about that. Dick Gregory talked about that. Mr. Fuller talked about that. Just trying to be informed about your environment. Other folks who dialed. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I love how you contrast Seattle compared to cities that are more black. So, Gus, I'm convinced. I also want to be on a good plantation. I want to move to Portland. I think that will oust Seattle, you know, and white people even call it Whitelandia. So I would imagine that the resources there would probably be much more significant than what I get in New York, because there's just too many black people for white people here. You know, they're not going to give too much. But even in contrast to that New York story you played, where the program is about cash bail and letting people, would have let 20,000 people would have not been arrested or been sent to jail. They would have been released if this program was in effect a year ago. And your story in Seattle was about letting people out of library prison. You know, just a total contrast. I draw that same contrast, and I love to make the comparison, because they're, you know, just so much when you look at these two cities, Philadelphia and Phoenix. Philadelphia, the sixth largest city, Phoenix, the fifth, about the same amount of people, about 1.6 million people each. Phoenix, slightly more people, but Philly has significantly more black people. So Philadelphia has 6,500 police officers, and Phoenix has 2,900 police officers. 42% of Philly is black, and only 7% of Phoenix is black. So that, and then you could even take that same, those same two cities, and say Phoenix has 42% of so-called Hispanic Latino people, and they're not being policed like black people are. You know, in a city like Philly, where there's 40%. Black people. So you can do a lot of good comparisons between those two places. As soon as I saw the shooting, I texted Mr. Firefighter White Settlement. Look at the name of this place. So I'm glad you put that out. I had that written here. But man, I don't think I would live. I think one of the victims is black. Man, I would not go anywhere near White Settlement. I would stay away from there. I take white people very serious. They're telling me they don't want black people there. The fake Jewish attacks, that's what I call them. If there was a group of anti-Semitic, in quotes, violent Hebrew Israelites in Jersey City, you would have seen raids and mass arrests all throughout the news for the last couple of weeks of them arresting these radical Hebrew Israelites all throughout the tri-state area. They're all over. You don't see any of that. These are random attacks. They keep showing black teens, it looks like, in a lot of them, playing a knockout game or something, and to show them the tail end. A lot of them seem like the tail end of a verbal altercation between a black person and a person dressed like they're Hasidic. And now you see the tail end, and that's the physical part. But it looks like there was something happening before. It just wasn't a random thing. They show young black child knocking off one of their big hats. Black female fighting a Jewish man. swastika written on the wall. Someone scribbled over one of the candle lights on the Hanukkah candle. I mean, just, and then with all these tracks, you get this stabbing. Now, this guy is a mentally challenged, clinically insane individual. I watched a press conference with his lawyer, his mother, and another press conference that the military did. This guy was a person in the military. He suffered head trauma. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia by the United States government. He rides around with bleach on him because he thinks things are crawling on him, and he washes himself down with bleach. They said he wouldn't even comprehend hate group propaganda to even join one. But they're all treating this like it's a hate crime. And I think this is totally wrong. This person is totally mentally ill. 59.8% of hate crimes were committed against people based off of race last year. 18.7% was based off of religion, which would qualify for these Jewish attacks. So how would they even make this these hate crime things a Jewish thing? How many times do we see on this show where there's an obvious hate crime because the white person said nigger or something before they committed the crime and they don't get charged? I mean, we would have much more, I think. I think those officers who arrested broke into the black woman's apartment and did whatever they did, called her a nigger and everything else, their records should be collected by prosecutors or any prosecutions that were led to convictions, and they collected the evidence. Those cases should be reviewed. These people have shown that they are racially biased, and being that I'm sure most of the arrests made were against non-white people, they should have all of that stuff looked if we are in a system of justice. And I mute my line. I doubt that the chief of police is going to do anything. He just got there. He doesn't want to. The last time the chief of police fired someone, which was Ken Paleo, he had to resign because they don't play that too much. So also, the big push for them moving people off of Rikers Island. Rikers Island is between the Bronx and island between the Bronx and Queens, closer to Queens. And they want to enlarge LaGuardia Airport, and it's right next to the airport, so they could have a little bridge where the planes can go there and use that as the runway. That's really the real push behind them getting rid of. It's not for the betterment of the black people to keep them closer to their home. No, they're doing this for money. I'll get my line. Thank you.
Point about Officer Reynolds. And, hey, let's examine all of his arrests. Because someone with this sort of conduct, hey, maybe this is not the first time that he said nigger. He said he didn't even remember, so maybe he doesn't remember the other times that he's used the term or just practiced racism without using the term. Excellent point. Let me get what you said. The suspect in the stabbing of the so-called Jews, you said that it's reported that he washed himself with bleach. Is that correct?
Yeah, because that was part of the case, was that he was riding around with bleach and he smelled like bleach. Mm. You know what I'm saying? And when his mother did a press conference, she was talking about recently he's been more and more uncontrollable with his schizophrenia to the point where he is washing himself with bleach to get some things that he thinks is crawling on him off of him. He's saying only the bleach works. Mm. So this is military, like he was in a roadside bomb and suffered head trauma type, you know, like this wasn't like someone that was off there. I don't want to use a metaphor. He hasn't been insane his whole life. This was caused by the military. They had a general saying, reading his record, you know, like showing that this guy is not a hate crime, but Schumer, Gillibrand, I mean, even de Blasio, all saying, oh, we got to do all this stuff because this is an attack on the Jews. And then they said, oh, well, I think it was 6 years ago, he looked up, why does Muslims hate Jews? And this is the reason why they're charging them with a hate crime. It's like, are you serious? Like, racism, white supremacy.
The bleaching component, I think that is, all of that the military history, so many aspects of that. We just finished Mumia Abu-Jamal's book. He was in the Black Panther Party. They talked about excusing black people from military service. The book Protest Psychosis, where there's a long history of racists labeling black people as mentally defective or schizophrenic or whatever it is, whether they have a disorder or not, that is a long history of racism, medical apartheid. But the bleaching specifically, saying that that's a part of his psychosis or mental trauma from racism, white supremacy, military service at all. But the bleaching, to have a black person in the system of white supremacy and a part of their response involves bleaching. That's just a part of the environment that we're in, where you have black people who are quote unquote sane, who we spend millions with. Sorry, wrong letter, consonant. We spend billions annually bleaching. And then they say that this fella is got some mental problems and he also is bleaching. All of this sort of thing happens. Dr. Welsing, I would have loved to hear her commentary on that. All of these sort of behaviors happen, should be looked at within the context of white supremacy. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, comments to share, line should be open.
Can I be heard? You can go. Thank you, sir. Greetings, everyone. No, I wasn't going to. I was just joking with the bride. Actually, I was kind of nervous on that incident that you were talking about. Because of the danger of the construction around the area, that sort of thing, and properly turning off of the road. I actually thought when it was requested that one needed to go to the bathroom, I thought it was all the way at the airport itself. But anyway, moving on. The only story that I have to report is a kind of like a juxtaposed in South Florida, City of Miami. Tragically, four children died in a house fire. The ages were from, I think there was as old as 11 years old to 1 year old. All of them were related. All of them shared the same grandmother. But it didn't get a lot of publicity, a lot of news. And I was comparing it to an incident where a white female that died in a plane crash, went national. I don't even know who this person was. And I actually texted Mr. Thomas on it, in stating that these children did not have a choice in the matter that caused their death. But by airing the story, it could help possibly save the lives based on the information on what took place in the house fire. It can benefit others. Well, everybody knows based on my background, anytime that something like that nature takes place, it's terrible, but the best thing one can get out of it is some knowledge that you or someone else does not get the same, be involved in the same type of tragedy based on understanding of what took place. DCS program was canceled today. Didn't have a session today. Mr. Clark needed a deserving rest. And that's the end of my report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. He is true to his name. He did inspect to keep us safe while we were there. Was looking out for fire hazards while we were there. True to his occupation. Much obliged. Imhan Deesey, thank you for yielding the floor, sir. Did you have commentary?
Yes, sir. Greetings and greetings to everyone. And I wanted to also say, of course, I'm happy that the retreat went well. It's always good to get some stretching, do some stretching every day, you know, if you can. And I want to say I'm an American. White people are not Americans. And I think one way we can solve the problem of white supremacy is that white people leave America. And I think black people should agree that white people should leave America. I wanted to say about the shooting that happened at the church. One of the shootings I saw, guy came in with a long gun and shot someone and got a few shots off. But one person shot him. One of the church members shot whoever was the active shooter with one shot. That's a marksman. That's somebody who goes to the range often. That's probably somebody who has like a range in the backyard. And then there were six gunmen altogether who from the church, I think the number was six gunmen who all presented their gun and walked towards the individual after the individual was shot dead, the active shooter. And then, so what I was saying before about white people carry guns at these churches and that they carry the guns, but it's not as visible because it's under the shirt. And so they keep their guns under their shirts, and because it's under their shirts, it's hard to see. But they're armed, and like I said, these top shooters on YouTube, like, they're really, really good. I mean, they pull their guns out of this place and that place and just shoot their target, like, real, real quick, like, in a second. Well, anyway, they talk about training the white people at churches. And then so at my church, you know, I'm a musician. And so I carry, but I carry to where it's not very visible. The pastor knows I carry. He does martial arts. We talk about a lot of martial arts. We talk about active shooters, what happens in that type of case, you know. But it's something that black people should speak about. And white people need to leave America. That's the main point. Thank you.
To your point, really quick, we'll save everything else about the retreat for the recap. But as I said, we were watching and investigating when the Texas, the white settlement church shooting happened this past weekend. The second time we went to the gun range, the suspected racist who was doing the training with us, and he trained us the first time we went to the range as well, he began talking about the church shooting. He knew all of the details. As I said, he knew the type of gun that the security officer used. He was even critiquing, because one of the security members at the church got shot and killed, and he was critiquing, like, he was too slow on his draw. He knew the way. In fact, I was shooting with a Sig Sauer. That was the weapon we were using the second day, which, wow, I love. Hey, that's even a story about why we were shooting with that particular weapon. But he said, oh, I think that's the weapon that the shooter had. But, I mean, he knew exactly. Like, he knew the exact specifics of, oh, he had this weapon, and boom, boom, boom. He went through all codification. Codification. And then I thought of infamous, it's been a decade, white people kill for fun. But yeah, the people at the gun range, they were very, very well informed about the shooting at White Settlement, Texas. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Hello.
Irie in Louisiana.
Hello, everybody. Let's see. What is this? Okay, so when Imam DC says that white people should leave, it's funny to me because I had a dialogue with a racist suspect that's roommates with a friend of mine, her brother, non-white. And I had to tell him, look, you're living with somebody that I suspect not only practices racism, but is capable of extreme, fatal contact with you if he gets ready. Because when I met him, he had a shirt on about, jiu-jitsu. And we, during the conversation we had, or argument, I guess, it got to a point where I had told him, and I wasn't as codified as I am now, I was like, you know what, y'all should just leave. Y'all should leave, and I used a metaphor. I said, y'all should just put everything y'all got in the bag and leave it and go back to Europe, since y'all want to be, you know, around each other so much. And he said, well, what are you all going to do with everything when we leave? And I remember saying, it's none of your business. Just, you always trying to manage something. Go, goodbye. Like, it was crazy. But every time he says that, I think of that. And then in regard to the bleaching situation, I didn't catch that particular part, but I saw a documentary on YouTube about the Philippines. They're bleaching in the Philippines, and they're so adamant about it, people with money, that they go to a dermatologist, a female dermatologist, for IV drips, and she calls it the Cinderella drip. Interesting. Cinderella drip. And she said she wants to make the Philippines the most beautiful country in the world. And I saw a documentary, well, not a documentary, a TED Talk that Thomas might be interested in. It was presented by Q Her, Hotel Echo Romeo Romeo. And it's about bionics for amputees or people that don't have, you know, body parts. But then what I found interesting is they're suggesting that the human body that is fully, has all its appendages, that it could be augmented with parts that are, AI or whatever, to aid in, you know, your body function and movement, so forth and so on. And I'm like, well, you know, how convenient, just make it where there's no part of life eventually that isn't controlled by these adaptive devices. Like, you won't even probably be able to brush your teeth without something, you know, or with extreme technology being involved, and it's really invasive and ridiculous. I do see the benefits of people without limbs, but otherwise it's too much, way too much. And there was one other thing I wanted to say. It's just really humorous to me how white people, when they have to do right, such as returning something stolen to people, that they always have to be compensated to do so. You know, the tax credit and everything, like, no, like, just it should be given back or it should be taken back. There shouldn't be any coaxing financially to get them to do the right thing. But then again, at the same time, it's just not in them to do the right thing. I don't think, not now and not ever. So I don't know how the problem exactly is going to get solved, but they surely won't be helping. Oh, one last thing, Gus. If the people that I'm doing this parent-teacher summit with are adamant about inviting Mr. Wise, I'm going to challenge them to invite him and to speak pro bono and see what they say, and tell them to see what he says, and then maybe that'll reveal his position on replacing the system with justice for them to see for themselves. And I'll mute my line. Thanks.
I would try to think of some ways that that not that it will cause you any problems. Everything is always doing things in a manner that does not produce any problems for you. But either pro, I think that's a phenomenal idea to see if he'll do it pro bono. If you can think of black people, if it's an organization, person, victims of racism who could use assistance, hey, donate these funds to boop, locally. If it's a group of children or whatever it is, donate this to them so that they can do, you know, whatever it is. That would be Black History Month is coming up. Donate this for boop. You know, whatever. You could think of that if anybody else can think of examples. And certainly, if this is something where you're going to be present, at least one good question. There's probably several other things that you could think of. Compensatory investment request, that might be a good one. It's a whole lot of things. If they're adamant on having him there, I would try to think of at least one thing that I could do if he's going to be present that would be an act of counter-racism that is not going to cause me any problems. Certainly, you can't, you know, be omniscient and know everything, but to the best of your ability to use reason, logic, based on what you know, this is not going to cause any problems for me down the road, or this will not cause any problems for me in the future by me asking this question, making this request. But I would, if Mr. Wise is going to come, let's have counter-racist fun. Let's see. Other folks that have dialed in, if we have not heard from you at all, let me give the number again really quick. 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. Gus, what was that term that you used in regards to the cop, the race soldier covering up the other race soldier's racism?
Unjust networking.
Oh, okay. Yeah, unjust networking. Because when I thought about that, I also thought about here locally in Chicago, the Laquan McDonald unjust networking. But, you know, that's an element of white supremacy, the race soldiers that maintain the system. And this is the essence of a system. There was no meeting that happened. They didn't get on the phone and talk to each other. They just automatically covered it up. So it's like they showed up and the cover up just happened. So that is the system. That's how it works. In regards to the, you know, in the basic level of it. You also mentioned about passports and suggestions to get passports. I believe it is this year where Homeland Security is going to require people to have passports flying domestically in the United States. And I think that takes place in October. May be wrong, but I know here in Illinois they've been advertising it where we can get a what they call a real ID, where people can fly domestically across the United States, and if you don't have a real ID, then you're required to have a passport. And like I said, I believe in this year, and I believe it starts in October. So I might want to double, you know, I'll probably double check that. The issue of Jews or people who call themselves Jews, the audio you played about Neely Fuller asking that question about, you know, white people, black people, and Jews, more confusion in regards to, you know, who's a racist, because, you know, I think there's more confusion comes in when people start to lump, you know, races with anti-Semitism or even like homophobic. You know, they want to lump all, you know, they want to put, you know, put all these together with races. And obviously we all know that, you know, racists are white people who like to subjugate non-white people. So when you talk about the different groups of, you know, Jews, Hispanics, who could possibly be white or non-white? So that's where the confusion comes in. You know, it's almost like labeling somebody, American. You know, an American could be a white person or a non-white person. So that's where the confusion comes in with that. A previous caller was talking about more homeless, mentally ill people on the streets. I know that has been prevalent here in Chicago because of the fact that the previous mayor, Rahm Emanuel, and Richard Daley, before him, two of the top race soldiers in Chicago, or mayor of Chicago, they closed a lot of the mental health facilities, in particularly in the Black community, because you see a lot of Black homeless and mentally ill people on the streets of Chicago. And they're, oh my God, it has increased big time here in Chicago in the last couple of years because of the closing of these facilities. So I don't know how prevalent is that in the other major cities like New York and Philadelphia. And as what Irie, the caller Irie had stated about skin bleaching in the Philippines. Yes, I've been to the Philippines before, and they promote that. They promote skin whitening creamers. And if you look on their media, media in the Philippines, there's nothing but light-skinned Filipinos that's on their television. That's all you see basically on their TV. But if you go there, you would see predominantly darker-skinned Filipinos running the streets. So if you would look at it on TV, you would think that there were just, you know, more light-skinned Filipinos. But if you actually go there, you'd see more dark-skinned Filipinos than anything. So that's all I have right now.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Despite my despite my commentary from before, we should probably look, if possible, at some point, see if we could do a retreat in Chicago. It would have to be between June and August, because Chicago is very cold, and I do not like cold weather, and those are about the only months that I could be there when it would not be cold. But yeah, we could go see if we could visit Dr. Welsing, some of her old areas. And yeah, they got lots of reasons where we should maybe look at that if we could get to Chicago at some point. But the mental health closures, extremely important. And I suspect that that is a pattern in areas that have a high concentration of Black people. I don't think they have a rash of closings of mental health clinics in the Seattle region. I have to double check to be certain. But I don't think that's the case. They have injection sites here. So, but that word again, hopefully in 2020 we can do better. We do not have in the system of white supremacy a Black community. If there was a Black community, we would have all of the adequate mental health facilities that we need. Other folks that we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary to share, and especially if you haven't spoken at all, make sure you get a hand up, *61. But if you have commentary to share, proceed. Well, folks, sir. Getting their thoughts together. We should have the author of the book Skimmed on the program, Andrea Freeman. She is a white woman. I'm really looking forward. I got the book in the mail this week. Dorothy Roberts, black female. She's been a 3-time guest on the program. I said, man, we need to get her back on the broadcast. But she's on the book jacket for Skimmed and talking about this work. This book is about how racists, it's chemical and biological warfare. That was one of the questions I want to ask. Racists deliberately got black mothers to stop breastfeeding their offspring and substituted that with formula, inferior substitute. Is that chemical and biological warfare? That's one of the questions that I want to ask Andrea Freeman. But she should be coming to the Cow shortly, very beginning of 2020. Always enjoy having white guests on the program, so be prepared if you want to check out the book in advance. Do a little research. She should be coming. You should have time to get your questions together. Let's end the retreat. I guess you'll just have to be mindful. You can check Black Talk Radio Network and the Facebook page as well for the updates about when we will do the retreat recap. Hopefully I'll be able to put a photo montage together as well, so you can see a little bit of what we experienced down in Florida. Didn't really take photographs when we were in Virginia, but was able to get some pictures in this time, so we'll be able to share that and hopefully motivate that passport. That's why I said I think it might be good for everybody, all of us, to have, you know, to have that documentation in case you want to do a little traveling. Some opportunities present themselves to go hither, yonder. That can be helpful. Get that passport, May 21 to May 24. Toronto, counter-racist yoga retreat. We'll see if we can do the gun range again. Eat great. Do some exercise. Vegan delights should be fun. And Toronto in warm weather is, wow. Let's see. Folks still spectating or getting their thoughts together. Other folks who had commentary to share. It seems folks are still taking a bit of time to collect their thoughts. If there are people in the New York area, that would be one I would pay attention to with regards to workplace racism, because I suspect the so-called anti-Semitism will come up in the workplace. If we have folks that are in that area and it does, you can feel free to write in or email for workplace racism. But I would already be thinking about what I'm going to say or not say, and it would be very little about any of that in a workplace environment. But I would be stunned. There are probably some other locations where it would seem likely that that type of dialogue would come up. You should have a response prepared. Black History Month is coming up as well. I think I mentioned that earlier in the program. You should probably already be thinking about some tackiness with regards to that, because they'll be probably getting plans together for Black History Month ceremonies on the job and other places, so you can be prepared and take advantage. The caller who mentioned before about Tim Wise, coming, I think, affiliated with her job, coming to speak. They're insistent on having him to come in and speak. There are probably going to be a lot of white people who come in and do some speaking engagements next month or even this month for Dr. King's holiday as well. Be prepared with questions. I just mentioned Andrea Freeman's coming on the program. That's an opportunity to ask questions there. Let's not be spectators in 2020. As many opportunities as we get to refine our practice of counter-racism, questioning suspected racists, let's take advantage. And right at the beginning of the year, I think I have been told from the publishing industry, these first 2 months are, what do they call it? They're advantageous to publish books about niggers at this time of the year. I think they had that Timothy Tyson, suspected racist. He had that book about Emmett Till and his murder, and this white woman lied about it, and she knew about it, all that. He published it in January. And that's because, as I said, it's Negro History Month. Dr. King's holiday. Oh, wow. We can get our book at the front of Barnes & Noble, and at the public library they'll have displays for Black History Month and all that, so it'll be really easy. We can push books that are about black people during this time period. So these folks might be coming to a local bookstore or a college campus or a library or whatever. Take advantage. Ask questions. Don't spectate in 2020. Let's get this problem solved. Dr. Welsing used to talk about, let's solve the problem of racism by 2020. Let's have a sense of urgency. Get out there and practice a little counter-racism, or practice more. Let's see. Folks that are with us, any additional comments, questions they wanted to make sure they got in?
Can I be heard?
Thomas, yes, sir.
Yes. Never a good idea to talk about anything with Jewish related at the workplace. Yeah, that's not a good idea at all. Nor is it a good idea to get into a religious conversation or a political conversation in the workplace, but in particular with Jewish people. They're very free to say what they want to and you won't be. They're very cunning and the most homogenous group of white people on the planet, I would say they are. If you really look at it, I heard Richard Daley earlier, and you had in the book, you just reading Frank Rizzo. Around that same time, you had Ed Cox, the Irish, the Italians, and the Jews practicing racism against black people. In the 1940s, I remember you had an episode where someone said in 1945 they were called Irish Americans, Italian Americans, and then by the next census, they were all looped into the word white. And they've taken that power that they got from that grouping, and they've used it well. So every now and then they try to act like, oh, well, they try to sell you on. They came here under marginal conditions, and, it's sort of like we're the same, and we're not. Very much different. But in particular, with Jewish people at the workplace, and the most workplaces that I've worked at, be it a big company or small one, Jewish people at the very top of the workplace that's making the decisions, strategically placed within specific parts of the workplace. The other thing I wanted to say is potential, I've heard for years, on different shows about this conflict between the United States and Iran. And just the other day, the president attacked an Iranian general and blew his car up with a drone as he drove down the road, pinpoint accuracy. No one's going to get killed in that mission. And I've heard about this coalition between Russia, China, and Iran, and yet none of that has happened. It's not going to happen. With this whole attack, though, how smart the white supremacists are, is they label this guy who's a I don't know how they get elected or selected, but general for his country, they labeled him as a terrorist in the UN. So when they killed him, they didn't kill a general, they killed a terrorist. So they're not going to get in trouble for it. There's nothing that's going to be done. And this is just how they run a global system. It's not just here. They can do this anywhere. But they didn't even have a person down on the ground. Didn't shoot a shot. Had a drone fly over this guy while he was driving down the highway. Yep, that's him. Hit him with the bomb. And then they got a picture of him, his hand hanging out the car with his ring on. So people knew it was him, all done by a drone. No person, and this is where they're at, the level of sophistication that white supremacy has come to. And I mean, what I'm thinking, guys.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Let's see. Other folks who are with us have commentary that they would like to share. Assume folks are satisfied for the moment. If there are people, if you think you might have a comment you want to get in before we wrap up, please do not wait till the last 5 minutes of the broadcast. If you think you might want to participate, if you have not got your hand up at all, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I did not include David Stern, NBA commissioner, died. NPR had a report about how he worked against housing discrimination. Now, I was going to play that today or today. I try to play things that, you know, have happened within the last 7 days. That counts. And it was workplace racism. But I was conflicted because I thought, number one, some of the things with David Stern, that could be workplace racism. Bill Roden had quite a bit to say about David Stern. Bill Roden is a black male journalist. He wrote $40 Million Slaves. He wrote for the New York Times for about 3 decades. He writes for The Undefeated now. But he had quite a bit to say about Bill Roden, and most of it would qualify for workplace racism, about how he made things more difficult in some respects for certain black males, denied black males job opportunities in some respects. Most of what he said qualified for workplace racism. But I didn't play that report because I was conflicted. One, I said, I might play some of this for workplace racism later. Two, they said, or they were examining David Stern's, and I think he's so-called Jewish too, if that means anything, suspected racist. But they were examining his record of working against housing discrimination. And when I think housing discrimination, David Stern, NBA, I immediately think Donald Sterling. Like, he was, like, accused, conclusive, practicing racism, white supremacy, and housing discrimination against black tenants. No surprise. that's what I think of. And David Stern, that was one thing Bill Roden said, like, hey, it was public knowledge that Donald Sterling was a racist, and you let this guy hang out in the league for a long time, practicing housing discrimination, as they call it, racism with regards to residents, being allowed to get a residence. And you let this guy hang out for years. It took, it took the whole situation with the recording, but he wasn't even commissioner at the point that happened. That was Adam Silver, who finally said, oh yeah, you got to be out of here, and made him sell the team. And he got $2 billion for that. So, I mean, that wasn't even a punishment in my opinion. But yeah, I was conflicted about playing it. I even was conflicted, you know, how important is this in the scheme of racism, white supremacy? Now, basketball is a billion-dollar business, but I was conflicted. Either way, we'll hear a bit of it as we proceed. But David Stern did die this week, and many, many people are very aware of the NBA all around the world. We've had many dialogues about racism, white supremacy that could have been, maybe should have been, included in the audio segments as well. Let's see.
Can I say something, Buzz?
Thomas in New York.
Yeah, David Stern. If you look at the NBA's meteoric rise to become one of the top sports in the country, it's primarily because of David Stern. When he became the commissioner, he decided that he was going to sell race and racism. He put out the Larry Bird versus Magic Johnson whole thing. This was the late 70s into the 80s, and most white people were diehard Celtic fans, and most black people were rooting for the Lakers, and the Lakers had a mostly all-black team, and the Celtics had a mostly all-white team, and that was the promotion of the league, even down to the sneaker commercials with Magic and Bird together, where he said it was the first time they ever sat down and actually talked to each other, you know, but they were being promoted as rivals, you know, black versus white. Same time you had Rocky versus Apollo Creed. So that, to me, is David Stern's legacy, not to also mention the cheating that was exposed by Tim McAlmey, I think his name was, the referee. And David Stern paid him almost $50 million to edit the book that he put out on the NBA cheating scandal. So there's a lot of with David Stern that goes under a lot of black people, in particular former players. They praise him.
And I'm like, man, he's just another racist white supremacist. About sickle cell. And, sickle cell primarily. If you live in regions where you have malaria-bearing mosquitoes and West Nile-bearing mosquitoes, because the blood has mutated to the point where that doesn't affect, but even some poisonous snake bites don't affect people with sickle cell. And those are primarily real regions where that disease or, say, disease or that mutation naturally occurred to keep people from getting sick from those airborne diseases and, you know, insects and stuff like that bites. When you look at the sickle cell, how it's being promoted, along with AIDS. Now, when you think of sickle cell, you think black people, you know, and unfortunately, when you think AIDS, you know, you generally can associate that, especially here, you know, with Africa, the United States, they're going to associate that with black people. But these are the two things, two of the major things that they're using to promote this CRISPR apparatus, which is going to become human enhancement and done from a fetal state, or even before the baby is conceived, they can take the sickle cell gene out of that, you know, fetus or the cell, whatever, and that baby won't be born with sickle cell or be born immune to AIDS, you know. But using this on black, you know, diseases that there's a few other diseases when you look at them that they're saying that they can fix with this CRISPR right now. And you could associate those to highly in the black community. And it just goes to my point. The CRISPR is just advanced eugenics. Who have they been studying all this time? Us. You know, this is their studies all, you know, coming true. Like they finally mastered it. You know, so this is just advanced eugenics. When you look at the dynamics this is going to make, when you have a child who can be enhanced, right, they call this human enhancement, and you can find all types of documentation on this total valid science, probably the most funded thing in the whole world. They want to be able to live for 200-300 years, and they figured they could do that by making themselves enhanced to the point where they can't get cancers, they can't get these ailments, or they're born with perfect vision, born at the perfect height. This is all coming true. Those babies will not be humans, though. Those will be mutants, you know, and then you're going to have a whole new form of supremacy, because those people will be inherently genetically eugenics better than the people who are able to afford those processes. You understand? And it's going to change everything, but we're at the very beginning stages of that. And that just the point that of all the diseases and things in the world, the one thing that they could 100% say they've mastered right now is AIDS and sickle cell. I mean, why don't I think you guys?
Dorothy Roberts talked quite a bit about sickle cell in her writing. I think particularly Fatal Invention. That was the third time she was a guest on the program. She talked with suspicion because they will try to say that is a black person's disease. And she's said pretty consistently that's not true. There are lots of non-black people around the world who get sickle cell, and they'll try and do manipulative things when they say that this is a black person's disease. It's lots of reasons where Dorothy Roberts, her name, she's top 10, Killing the Black Body, phenomenal. She's written several books, Killing the Black Body, Shattered Bonds, Fatal Invention, even more. Reports, amazing scholar, Dorothy Roberts, top 10, Killing the Black Body. But we should see if we can get her back on the program for 2020. Many questions to ask her on many different subjects. Man. The CRISPR as well. I'm sure she would have some thoughts on that as well, and all of what looks like it could be, in many respects, white people's enhancements, genetic mutations, as it were. It's been a long week. That jet lag, told you I'm still getting acclimated to getting back. Other folks with us have questions, comments, suggestions.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Yes. I was thinking about this, the incident in regards to the stabbing in the Muncie, where the guy who they said that was mentally ill with the machete that was quote-unquote big as a broom, I think, how they were saying that he was mentally ill. And I think this case might be setting a precedent, not a new precedent, but I keep thinking about there was a book that was published about a year or two ago in regards to Donald Trump being mentally ill. And I've always, you know, I don't know why I'm thinking about this as well, but, you know, with the Donald Trump thing being mentally ill, to me it sounds like an excuse for them to say, well, you know, Donald Trump, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing, so he's not really, you know, he's not really in charge of his own self because of his mental facilities is being compromised by mental illness. And I think, you know, I think that's a lie to give him an excuse and to just basically say that he's really not a racist. He's just crazy, you know. And, you know, as you always say, you know, racists know what they're doing. You know, they're very conscious of what they're doing. Donald Trump is no different. I don't think he's mentally ill. He knows exactly knows what he's doing. So I keep thinking about that when I thought about this case of the this attempted stabbing in the synagogue. So they're probably going to try to make racists just crazy, and you know they don't know what they're doing. They're just mentally ill. No, racists are not crazy. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're very conscious of what they're doing. So that's all I have of me in my life.
They are not ignorant about racism. And I thought that was important, too. Like, these incidents of so-called anti-Semitism, they're talking about changing laws as a result of this. Like, wow. I mean, think of all the times that black people are the victims of all sorts of crimes. And rarely is there some talk of actually changing laws to ensure the safety of black people so that they're no longer victims of these types of crimes. Like, that is amazing. But I mean, to be expected in a system of racism, white supremacy, it is very, very easy. Once accusations, a black person did something, oh man, we have got to go any means necessary. We're now justified any and all means to put down the Negro. Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Pardon that. Now that you all are talking about, you know, violence and mental illness and stuff again, I think that, well, now for me, I think mental illness for white people means it's basically the loss of the refinement in the thought, speech, and action by white people manifesting. And so whenever that goes away, then they, you know, chalk it under mental illness, because that's not supposed to happen. You're supposed to do it, but it's supposed to be covert and codified and look like something else. So non-white people can be confused. But when it's directly done and said in those ways, it's not refined, and so they consider the person crazy. And that's all I have to say. Thanks.
The use of the term crazy can be quite strategic, deliberate, methodical as well when someone is called crazy. Even the implications, because sometimes crazy doesn't quite mean the same thing. Other folks have comments, questions that they wanted to share, suggestions they wanted to share. We have about 10 minutes before we wrap up, maybe a little less.
Can I be heard? Oh, no, you can go ahead. Yes, sir. I thought someone was talking too when I was speaking, but I guess I'll just go ahead. So I was going to say about the chemtrails, the planes that dump this tremendous amount of chemicals into the sky, visible, very visible. So like I was saying before, they always spray these, well, they do it every day, but then they also do it very heavily right before very special events, like certain times of year. So Christmas, right before Christmas, they had the airplanes out very heavily. There was blue skies right before they had the airplanes flying. So many that, you know, I wasn't going to count. Anyway, I was going to say about white people. They're from a place that's very cold. And so if they're in an area that's not normally cold, they have to terraform the area. They have to change the environment to make it cold. Just like any other creature that's from the Arctic area or from the very cold regions. If you have a zoo and you bring those Arctic animals, you have to change the environment so that the animals can live. White people weren't able to live in the islands. They weren't able to live in Africa. And they have to actually change the environment for it to be this cold. It would be warm in December. I remember I think last January or the January before, it was 77 degrees. And the last thing I was going to say is if white people are not in America, it would be more difficult for them to spray these chemicals in the air and freeze us. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan Dicey. Caller in Florida?
Yeah, yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I had a few observations really quick on the, I think, the anti-Semitism, the reports and everything. I do find it interesting as well that the mentioning of mental illness is coming up, and I think it's a strategy behind that. Like they're saying, the attack from, I guess, the black male, they're using mental illness as well as applying the term terrorism, and this got to be a new type of domestic terrorism. Like they're trying to have a separate category, but I guess they haven't introduced an actual term for it. So maybe that could be coming up in the future as well. But when it's white people who have committed crimes, Affluenza or Dylan Roof, the person that was in El Paso, Texas, they use the term mental illness in video games. Also, to show that they have sympathy, or we need more mental health research and things like that. But for the black person, they used it in a different way to further criminalize the black person as the suspect. And then they can use that to say, if a black person points that out, well, what do you mean? The white person can say, what do you mean? We're talking about mental illness for black people too. Isn't that what y'all want us to do? Like they could further the confusion to that degree, in my opinion. I had two incidents. Well, not incidents, but news stories from around Florida. In Rosewood, they're going to make, I guess, January 1st, Rosewood Day. And I guess it's the 97th anniversary of the massacre, and apparently they're also planning to make a Rosewood Museum in 2023. I guess that's going to have more information on what happened with the racist massacre. And my last one is, it's a black male by the name of Tyrone Oliver, who ran for in Ocala City Council seat, and they went back. Now, see, he won for the election. So apparently they went back and said, hey, you know, you're an ex-felon. You know, we got to get you out of here. And they actually found a way to do it. And then he had to step down. He couldn't get the election seat. So they put it back up for election again. They opened up the election for the city council seat that he supposedly won on March 17th. So when it's white people and they do that, they pretty much ignore it and push to the side and just avoid it. So if you're black, they definitely going to probe every part of your past and use racism, white supremacy against you. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
That is surprising that generally if you're going to, I mean, this is not someone running to oppose President Trump, but even still, I think we were talking about county seats, commission offices, and sometimes, you know, these positions come with a salary that is not, you know, it's more than 20 cents. Vetting would take place. Nobody checked this guy's record prior to, like, him getting the seat. We just met this guy. Nobody did any sort of background check. Like, you go to work at McDonald's. I teach at the yoga studio. They do a background check. My goodness, they don't do any sort of investigation. That would be one where I would kind of think, like, wow, was this kind of planned? Because they do that sometimes, that you won and then, no, you know, you didn't. Or if somebody, oh, yeah, this nigger, he thinks he's going to win. We're just waiting and think he's got it all together. And then, bang, make sure we let him know about his, you know, criminal history. They probably use the metaphor, his checkered past. That metaphor is in the word guide. Anybody else, comments, thoughts they want to get in before we conclude? Everyone satisfied? Outstanding. Get your passport. May 21, May 24, Toronto, the Cows Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, 4 days, 3 nights, 660. Written information with all the details forthcoming. If you have questions, let me know. Really looking forward to going back to Toronto. If you have not been, wow, what a city. Particularly when the weather is nice, even when it's not so nice. Anywho, if you have any other questions, thoughts, you can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll be here for the recap at the probably earlier portion of the week. Just check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook page for the information, times, all of that jazz. Thanks everyone for participating, tuning in this evening. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. They said that Officer Reynolds, he was so intoxicated he couldn't remember what he did. I don't even remember if I called that nigger a nigger. If you work for McDonald's, I think, and they sent you out of town on training, how to make the best Big Mac, how to produce the crispiest chicken nuggets, and while at this training, you went to happy hour and got drunk and stumbled into somebody's house and called them a coon or whatever it is, I'm pretty sure you would get fired from McDonald's. Maybe I'm guessing. Be that as it may, sobriety is still the best procedure. I think I have said consistently that that's one of the worst combinations in the known universe. Whites and alcohol, that would be another piece of evidence to support that. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Just trying to do all the little things that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being sober and buckled up, we are not on the cell phone. If we are driving, trying to minimize contact with the Daniel Holtz clause, Amber Geiger's of the Known Universe. Before we sign out, I was able to duplicate one of the recipes. Chef Nadira, she was with us in Virginia and in Florida for the counter racist yoga retreat, doing all the vegan fixings. Most of them, actually, I did cook quite a bit in Florida, but she did most of the cooking, and she has made carrot hot dogs at both of the retreats. I finally watched enough and looked at the recipe this time around so that I could duplicate the carrot hot dogs, which got rave reviews both times. Gus T came home and made chili cheese carrot hot dogs. They were absolutely ridiculous. I have photos posted online so you can check them out in all their splendor. But I mean, wow. Vegan cheese that actually melts. I think you could maybe, it's been a while since I've had cheese, but I think you might be able to slip this cheese by a meat eater and just not tell them, and they would just think it's regular cheese. Like, I'm not quite sure. The carrots, amazing. You have to season them. You can't think carrot hot dog that it's just a raw carrot on a bun. Not even close. You have to season them and marinate them and cook them so that, you know, it's pretty close to a hot dog. And I mean, you know, most of the hot dogs that people like, it's just the seasonings and flavoring. You can get all that with a carrot. It can be absolutely delicious, a way to eat carrots. But chili cheese carrot hot dog, it was foolishly delicious. Woo. Might have to, that's an easy one I think we could duplicate at the retreat. Most of that is just marinade and doing the prep work the day before, and then it's easy to do the cook. You just marinate, all the work is doing the marinade and a little cook work, prep work the day before, and then let them soak, get all that flavor, bam, and then you can do the easy cook the next day. But chili cheese carrot hot dogs in Toronto, we could do it out on the grill. May 21 to May 24. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.